Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Down in Front. Our movie this week is Ghostbusters.
Oh, 2.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Not Ghostbusters 02.
But you've already clicked
that would be
play.
Like that would be like Blues Brothers 2000. Yeah. Ghostbusters 02.
Here you are, and you are trapped. Before we get started and talk about who's at the table today and what we've been drinking, go ahead and press play on your Ghostbusters 2 DVD, VHS, beta tape, iPod, whatever you've got, and press pause when the old crummy Columbia Pictures logo fades to black. The first frame you perceive of all black is when you should press pause. As I have pressed pause here, and in a second, I'll say 3, 2, 1, unpause. On the plosive of P in unpause, I'll press play, you'll press play, and guess what will happen? We'll watch the movie together in perfect sync, and it'll be like any other official commentary, except, of course, this time it will not be official. It will be with four friends in your head, and those friends this week are myself, Teague Christie, and as always, Mr. Brian William Finifter.
Hello.
Michael, the Dorkman Scott.
What's up?
And Trey, the Amazing Stokes.
Here we go.
Now, here we go with Ghostbusters 2, which is almost universally considered to be a poorly done sequel.
Inferior is a good word for it.
If you didn't see Ghostbusters 1, although it would be very surreal, well, you would have a problem with Ghostbusters 2.
That's quite possible.
However, for my part, I had only seen... I think I saw Ghostbusters for like the second time or something like that on Down in Front the first time. Since then, in the... God, it must have been like 7 months now. 7 months intervening.
That's what
I've actually seen it a few times, and I've come to really, really like Ghostbusters. However, as of now, I have still only seen Ghostbusters 2 once. Brian, what do you bring to the table?
You know, I know I've talked about this before, but as a kid, right now I'm just 6 years old again, and it doesn't matter. I know we talked about, I know I've mentioned it before, where it's, you know, as a kid I would watch Ghostbusters or Ghostbusters 2, and there's no distinction in my mind. There's just some moments that are Ghostbusters, and it doesn't matter which movie they're actually from. So, obviously, I've, you know, hammered them out for myself.
You've repressed this whole movie.
No, I haven't. We'll see. I mean, I actually haven't watched it in a while, but we'll see if it holds up for me. But I'm not as critical of it as I think Mike and Trey are going to be. So we'll see.
It's worth mentioning that Dorkman brings some extenuating circumstances to the table. What are those, Michael?
I just saw 2012. And I want to kill myself. Like, seriously, I sort of want to end it because I don't want to live in a world where that movie exists. But I don't want to let Trey go first. I want to go last because I think I might have the long intro.
Dorkman is our resident Ghostbusters expert. Is going to have a long-winded intro. Trey Stokes.
Now I want to watch 2012 and do that movie. I can't wait. Unlike the rest of y'all, actually, this movie is what, 89? 89.
Yeah, 1989. Ivan Reitman.
89, I remember quite clearly. I was working on The Abyss during 89. And all of us in the shop were very much abuzz about how they were finally going to come out with a sequel to Ghostbusters because Steve himself, my boss, Steve Johnson, had worked on the original Ghostbusters and designed the original Slimer slash Onion Head slash whatever you choose to call him. So there was a lot of anticipation for the movie when it came out. And then a lot of disappointment when we finally saw the end result.
So you were disappointed?
I was very disappointed. It's very blatantly a cash grab by everyone involved. It's a movie that they waited until the studio agreed to pay everyone God knows what exorbitant amount of money to show up and play Ghostbusters again.
Say the lines.
It's the Ocean's 12 of the Ghostbusters.
When was
body of
Ghostbusters
work.
The first one? When was that?
84.
They waited 5 years for the sequel.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a long time
to get everyone available again and get everyone to agree. And, you know, a lot of like, well, you know, this is one of those scripts that everyone like, well, I like my part of the script. And that's why no other human being likes the script, because it's only bits that everyone agreed that they would be willing to do. So it's just one of those. It's Ocean's 12. This is the Ocean's 12 of its era.
Over the course of this interview, we'll get into how it could have been better. But until that point, we have to fill ourselves with the 25 minutes of reasoning that Michael has for not liking this movie.
Well,
Darkman.
I can't remember how much into it I got in the original Ghostbusters, but I want to drive the point home again that this I didn't grow up on Star Wars. Like, I didn't watch Star Wars until high school.
This is your franchise.
This is my Star Wars. Like, this is literally, this is the first, Ghostbusters 1, not this one. Ghostbusters 1 is the first movie that I saw in theaters, and it just blew my mind wide open. And I watched the cartoon, and I had the toys, and it's like, it had, like a lot of people talk about with Star Wars, like, it still affects kind of who I am today. Like, I love comedy and action and horror and sci-fi and movies and visual effects. And, like, even my sense of humor is based off of, like, Bill Murray as Venkman and stuff like that to, you know, various degrees of success, depending on who you ask. But that's clearly where I kind of get the sarcasm thing from.
Wouldn't say clearly, but okay.
Yeah. That's where I get the idea for it from.
That's where I got the idea that comedy can work.
Yes, exactly. That people could be funny, and maybe I should try that.
give it a go.
But so you know, that's the, I was just like obsessed. So you know, 1989, like Brian, I'm 6 years old, and I don't know a damn thing. Like, winter still surprises me, because I haven't seen it that many times. I'm not reading the fucking Daily Variety or anything like that. I'm a kid, right? So just one day out of the blue, there's a commercial on TV for Ghostbusters 2.
Wow.
What sound, you know? What sound did you make?
No, you know how
No, you get to the story out of the sound.
No. You know how little kids are like pets that can talk? Like and it's real easy to get them to kind of go back to the feral roots, and like if they get really excited, they'll just jump up and start running in circles because they don't know what else to do with themselves. Like, I ran in circles for a week.
Wow.
Like I was so, like, it's seriously the kind of excitement that affects me on a quantum level. Like, I can think about it now 20 years later and still feel excited.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
It's like that much of a thing. And so, like, and that's when I started, like, you know, there was a cover story on Rolling Stone about Ghostbusters 2, and I made my parents buy me that magazine, and I didn't understand half of it, but I read it and looked at the pictures.
You got very, very into it.
So excited. And then you saw it.
And then
I finally saw it, and I was too young to know it wasn't good.
So there you go.
It's the kind of thing where it's like, just like Brian was saying, you know, to me, this is still part of the Ghostbusters story. It's an extension of Ghost. So this is actually probably going to be kind of a rough commentary for me, because I'm going to be sitting here and
we're going to be watching you hypnotically go back.
No. Well, it's either that or it's going to be like domestic abuse. Like, I'm going to be slapping this movie around, telling it I love it, but it kind of deserves it. You know,
you let me down.
Yeah,
you always disappoint me.
Why do you make me do this?
Yeah,
to you?
Why do you? You think I like hurting you like this, Ghostbusters 2? So we'll see. I genuinely, wow, like Brian said, I actually haven't watched this movie in some time. I'm familiar with it, and I actually can delineate what happened in Ghostbusters 1 versus Ghostbusters 2, if only because I've seen Ghostbusters 1 so many times.
Right, yeah.
I know all of it, so the bits that aren't in there are obviously Ghostbusters 2.
You really do have like an Uncle Touchy's Naked Puzzle Basement version of Ghostbusters. Like, your past reverberates.
I don't.
Did this movie hurt you?
No, it didn't. No, that's
where
the thing.
Did the movie
it didn't.
Touch you?
It really didn't. Like, this movie did not hurt me at all. And it's like
it hurt you too young for you to know that you're being hurt.
Well,
you thought this was just how Ghostbusters are supposed to
but
be.
You're repressing. You're in denial.
I guess we'll see, because it's the kind of thing where I can definitely intellectually remove myself and be like, well, this doesn't work. Because I'll freely, like, I haven't deluded myself into thinking this is a good film, right? I know that it's not. It's an inferior movie to the first one in pretty much every way. But emotionally speaking, it was still like...
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because it's more Ghostbusters, and how could that be a bad thing?
Right. Darkman, we love you, and we're here for you, and we want to tell you that this is an intervention.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Let's have a look.
So here we go. Get your mouse in the remote or your...
But I do want to say real quick before we go on, we have... They released this like twice on DVD.
The menu, yeah.
They have clearly abandoned all pretense of... because this menu is identical to the Ghostbusters 1 menu, except they replaced the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man with the Statue of Liberty. Basically what the plot of this film
is. Yeah,
does.
Exactly. They just admit it. It's like the first one, but there's a different thing walking down the street.
But to be fair, they released Ghostbusters in like both of the movies in one pack. So they produced both of them at the same time.
I guess. Well, this one, not the original one. Because a few years ago, like when DVD was the new thing, like Ghostbusters was one of the very first ones.
This was the first one with an animated menu. I'm sure this is for commentary.
I think it was a big deal.
And they had a mystery. They even have a mystery science commentary on that one. That was like a
really?
Big shocking thing.
Well,
yeah, the original Ghostbusters.
Mike or Joel?
DVD.
It wasn't them doing it like mystery science.
No.
Let's just so no one like picks up that DVD and gets all excited like they're mocking the movie.
No, it's the commentary, but they're little
silhouettes. But it's a serious commentary.
Yes.
And then they were like, Why? And they never did that again.
Yeah,
so.
it was sort of like a, you know, let's try this. But I imagine the menus were probably put together when they probably released them as a set, or they had both releases
but still,
ready to go.
My God.
Okay. Yeah.
At least put the museum on. It's still the building from the first
one. I know.
They didn't even bother to change the graphics.
Go.
We're 10 minutes into the episode. We should probably start the movie.
Yeah, God forbid. We still have to watch this damn thing.
Mouse on your remote, or finger on your mouse. Put your mouse on your remote.
I like to make my own fun. Thank
you. Go ahead and go 3, 2, 1, unpause.
I don't know what you do while you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah. Yep, and then 5 years later.
Five years later.
And I was like, wow,
it's Helvetica. It's okay. It's okay.
Boy, this is dirty. They didn't even remaster it. There's all kinds of dirt
it's
on
very
this
noisy.
Print.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, but, wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I like the... Dude, it's not CG, so I'm stoked.
Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, we'll see a lot of that.
Now,
in fact, we'll get to talk about the effects.
Is that the stuff you were talking about last time?
That's exactly the same stuff. In fact, a lot of some people worked on The Blob, worked on this movie as well, and there's a lot of tentacles. The people who ILM I think did most of the stuff. They used a lot of our similar tentacle type stuff. I remember there's a guy who was one of the key effects guys on Ghostbusters was monkeying with our tentacles before he went to do Ghostbusters 2.
Now here's
we just saw a subtitle where someone said, "Watch where you're going," and it was after a guy hit a girl in crutches, and I'm not sure who said what to
No, she screams that to him.
Okay, it'd be funnier if it was a New York movie and
Jesus,
the guy screamed that to her.
Watch where you're going.
Well, which is actually kind of a setup, in a sense. Like, the whole...
You sound so depressed.
The whole thing that we're going to see... 2012. The whole thing that we're going to see is that, you know, and we see this guy arguing with the meter maid in the background even still, is that the slime is powered by negative emotion. This is one of those movies. This is a 1980s, we're mean and we have to stop or else evil will destroy us type of movies.
As opposed to what kind of movies do we make now?
Well, no, I'm just saying. It was more heavy-handed. Like, we talked about with Superman 4. We didn't do Superman 4, but I referenced it in the Abyss and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mentioned Superman 4.
So... It's one of those, this is cool. It's a little radio-controlled thing.
I know.
That can make some serious banks.
The thing about this movie is, you know, is as impressive as the effects in the first one were, this one, of course, they had, the sky was the limit in terms of their effects budget.
Why does the guy hunk his horn?
Yeah. Moving. The carriage does steer out of the way, so there you go.
But the baby seems genuinely distressed.
You know, they were just over the top in terms of the effects they were able to do. I mean, here they've got an entire, you know, street blocked off to do this sequence of a baby carriage and everything going on. And a very cool... animated baby carriage going on. I mean, geez, for heaven's sake.
A lot of very smart cuts. Obviously, the baby is not in there.
No, certainly not. But, you know, these are not cheap sequences to do. This movie had a huge budget because it was the sequel to Ghostbusters, and they could do anything they wanted. It's kind of an unsatisfying opening, I think.
Yeah.
The teaser, it's like, it doesn't really have a punchline to it. It doesn't have an ending to it. It's just sort of a...
Well, neither did the first one, though.
What was the first one?
The first one was the librarian, and we just see her scream.
Yeah, but at least it ended on a cliffhanger. Oh my gosh, what happened to that lady? This one, it's like, if they kept that idea, the baby would have continued to go in traffic, and we would have gone out on the, oh my god, I hope the baby's okay, and then maybe found out later the baby survived, but just barely when they find out about it.
I love the Ecto-1, but I do like the Ecto-1A that we see later on. I like the soup because I just like busy design.
It'd be kind of funny to design a car from the 80s that basically accomplishes what every single franchise car did. So it's got like time travel, and it's
there's Gail Wallins.
Oh, hey, Gail. Long time no see. Who the hell is Gail Wallace?
Gail Wallace from Die Hard. It's that character actress you see in a lot of 80s movies. She works with Harvey Johnson on the news.
Oh, I thought it was going to be He-Man. I got a big laugh out of that because I was a big fan of He-Man.
Oh, I see what they're doing. They're doing birthday. It's basically they're saying that they're not successful.
Yeah. And this is, and I, you know, it's, I've already, I think I pointed this.
Wow, how does he look younger than the first movie?
Really? They had a lot of work done.
This right here, Jason Reitman. Future director of
Juno.
Oh, my
gosh, look at that.
Really?
Director of Juno and the upcoming Up in the Air.
And thank you for smoking.
Thank you
for smoking, yeah.
Wow. And the answer is, you're welcome.
That's good trivia. That is excellent trivia.
And, of course, his line is, my dad says you're full of crap. And the dad, of course, is the director of this film, his actual father.
That's perfect. Well, I did not know that.
How do you guys feel about Ivan Reitman as a director? I mean, has he done noteworthy stuff other than Ghostbusters and, I guess, Evolution?
His heyday was definitely the 80s. He did Stripes, which is great.
Oh, Stripes. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And you know,
I felt very torn in this episode, but this section of the movie, because I'm like, I like Ghostbusters and He-Man.
Yeah.
I don't know which He-Man, one I would Team like. Ghostbusters. Which
more,
am I doing?
More recently, he did, his most recent, I think, that he did was released as 6 Days, 7 Nights, which I actually like.
Is that him?
Yeah, I actually like more than I really probably should.
That was
should.
Anne Heche, Harrison Ford.
I only caught up with that on video recently, and although it's not perfect, there's actually parts of it I like. But before that, a major kind of, remember I'm the guy who did Ghostbusters, was Evolution.
I loved Evolution. Yeah. And it might be one of those things where Fig loves stupid movies. However, I really enjoyed Evolution.
It's not a great movie.
He did a number of movies. He's quite successful directing-wise. But this whole opening, already the movie started to lose me right here. I think I've pointed this out already. But it's 5 years later, and I know they've
back to square one.
I know they've tried to justify it, but it's like, apparently, you know, everything they ever did to, you know, actually saving ghosts and all the thousands of witnesses who saw them save the city from ghosts, no one believes in that anymore.
Right.
Somehow they forgot, you know.
Right. And that's really, I mean, the problem with this is that it's, you know, people say it's the same movie, and it is because they've started again.
They have to do exactly the same progression.
For some reason, it
is. No one believes you. Oh, my God, it's all true. Save us.
It is, and I feel like it's not... It's the kind of thing that could have probably worked on paper. Like, that may be the reason it kind of got through. Because it seems like an interesting idea to be like, oh, yeah, successful. Everyone expects them to be a big success. What do? We subvert that. But I, like, yeah, it just doesn't work. Maybe if this were a TV show and it were like it was canceled after the first season and then it came back like Family Guy like 2 years later and then it's like scraping themselves back up, you know, by their bootstraps or whatever. But even that only lasts you like 2-3 episodes.
So I guess that brings up the point that it's funny that Michael Dorkman Scott, who has somewhat famously rewritten sequels and prequels prior to this,
yeah,
for what he now says are movies that aren't his favorite of all time, can't really figure out how to finish Ghostbusters 1 into a sequel, even though it's his favorite franchise.
Well, the problem is, like I said, to me, it's never really occurred to me to think, what could I do differently with Ghostbusters 2? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, you know, it's Ghostbusters. It's Ghostbusters 2. It's a continuation of Ghostbusters. I can choose to take it or leave it. I can choose to take it or leave it, and I love Ghostbusters too much to leave it. So I just accept that this is Ghostbusters 2.
Well, I guess that one way you could handle it is not
now. Now, if they fuck up Ghostbusters 3,
that's where I was going. Yeah.
That's a different matter entirely because I will notice.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I was wondering because, well, Trey, do you have something real quick?
Well, I was just going to say, not only did they recycle the A plot, they've even recycled the B plot.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we're not picking up with Dana and Bill Murray together. They've been together and broken up, and now he has to woo her again in this movie. So it's like that too is going to be a retread of what we've seen.
Ivan Reitman's daughter,
the dog.
Yes.
Yeah, strangely enough.
Yes.
Now, what I was going to say is that maybe you can't do this for the sequel because you're too close to what is already the sequel. But if you had to do Ghostbusters 3 actually happening notwithstanding, where would you go with these group of guys? I mean, what can you say with the Ghostbusters that you haven't already said? It's not like Star Wars where it's a universe.
No. I think that's the other issue with me with redoing Ghostbusters. Or doing another Ghostbusters movie, whether we call it an alternate Ghostbusters 2 or Ghostbusters 3 or whatever you want to say. It's like the idea – it's not a thing that has a lot of like themes that you can wrestle with. Like,
well,
Star Wars and Matrix
they're universe movies, and this isn't. This is just a movie.
Ghostbusters is more of a franchise that doesn't really, in a world outside of Hollywood, in a true and perfect universe, this shouldn't be a franchise.
Right.
Is that Shia's dad in Transformers?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Are you shitting me?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is how I know him.
That actor's done a lot of stuff, yeah.
But I would say this is more like less like Star Wars and more like Indiana Jones to do this franchise properly. It's episodic. It's more like what big monster are the Ghostbusters going to fight this week?
And there's no saga involved.
No, there's no saga.
So another failure of this movie is the monster they fight in this one is not as big and bad as the monster they fought in the first movie.
Right, this one is just kind of a voodoo warlord.
This is like,
one was a god.
A bad wizard, and the last one was the destroyer of the universe.
Yeah.
Now, wait a second. What is the difference between an episodic franchise and a saga franchise?
A saga franchise has and we're essentially just making this up right now, but to be fair,
it's going to be a rule from now on.
Yeah, but we'll bring it up all the time.
We're simply defining our terms in our own way.
Yeah,
that's all.
So a saga franchise is the kind of thing like Star Wars or The Matrix or
it's more akin to a miniseries. There's an overarching, there's one larger story as opposed to, there isn't one large story behind.
So a saga feels like a book.
There isn't one large story behind.
Or a series of books.
Or Lord of the Rings would be a saga because it's telling one story.
The Dark Tower is a saga.
Yes. Whereas, it kind of...
I know, I didn't want to get you started.
Only thing that Indiana Jones movies have in common is that they have Indiana Jones.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And I mean, Indiana Jones, very similar to, you know, people talk about character arcs. Indy has no character arc.
Right.
Like, he doesn't really change over the course of it. So with episodes...
And if he does, they ignore it the next time they reboot.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a girlfriend. He fell in love. No, he didn't. She's
exactly.
Gone.
And that's the same with...
James Bond.
James Bond. Yeah. Yes, exactly. As soon as he said the girlfriend thing, we're both like, oh, there's another...
You know who can't keep a girlfriend? James Bond.
Yeah, because...
Which is what Indiana Jones started out as, is Spielberg's James Bond.
Right. But you know, episodic is just like episodic television. The idea is you could start watching at any point, watch in any order, and it doesn't matter because everything is essentially reset at the end.
At the end of the day,
exactly
the main characters aren't any different and the situation isn't any different.
Yeah,
isn't this Bart Simpson or Lisa Simpson?
No, it's not.
No?
No. But she
what's the actress? Yeardley Smith, right?
Yeardley Smith.
But it's close, but it's not.
And Nancy Cartwright is Bart. But, so ultimately, this one would be like Indiana Jones.
Right.
It's they go from point, and you could have a progression. Like I would have liked to see they're at the top of their game right now, then what? You know, you can have a B plot about
the fall from grace.
The fall from grace, or you can have a B plot about the other paranormal investigators.
The LA chapter?
Yeah, the LA chapter, or, you know, the other...
Who would have to be a bunch of douchebags.
Yeah, or the competitors even in New York, who would, of course, turn out to be exactly what Walter Peck thought they were, which more like the Frighteners, like they're working with the ghosts.
Yeah, if they were so successful and they saved the city, then yes, imitators and competitors would then spring up, would be a more, you know, a way to take the story in a new direction.
And it would almost be the kind. Well, maybe it's like, okay, now we're doing it. But it'd be the kind of thing where I've literally never thought about this before. But so if it sucks, I'm sorry. But it could even be the kind of thing where they have had imitators just kind of coming and going and stuff like that. So they've kind of learned to just ignore it and be like, well, we're the Ghostbusters and we don't have anything to worry about.
We're the original famous Rays.
So they so it's the kind of thing where it's almost like, you know, they have competitors who are like in league with the ghosts but get in more, you know, deeper than they think and end up like helping the bad guy, you know, the ghosts start to gain power because they want work and they want to get popular and stuff like that. But the Ghostbusters ignore them for a while because they're like, oh, what? It's the same thing. They're pulling seances and cold readings and stuff like that and blah, blah, blah. And by the time they realize there's something else going on, like, it's way out of control.
But now the problem with all of those stories is it's implied.
Is not art. I don't care. That's not art. Anyway.
It's implied in the first one that the only reason there is so much paranormal activity in the first movie is because the main, you know, Zool and the main is building it all up.
Yeah.
So once they defeat that, the logic of the implication of the story is that we'll all go away and they'll really be out of a job.
It won't all go away. It's just going to drop back down to normal levels. Because they have a baseline and then the Twinkie starts to grow.
But they're basically justifying why in our real life we don't see any.
Now here's something.
I love that character.
This is something that's
why we don't see any paranormal activity.
They would say we do.
Something that's especially sad about this movie is Peter McNichol, who is just, you know, a guy who showed up and walks away with most of this movie. He's almost the funniest thing in this entire movie.
He's amazing.
And
he's like Bronson Pinchot, like, for the longest time, I didn't know this wasn't the way he talked.
Yeah, like Bronson Pinchot, you know, really got himself on the map when he showed up for 5 minutes in Beverly Hills Cop and took the screen away from Eddie Murphy. You know, guy actually stole a scene from Eddie Murphy.
I was thinking Balky, but yeah.
Yeah. But long before that was his little 5-minute bit in Beverly Hills Cop.
What's going on here?
This is, you know, paranormal CG? Ghosty things.
That's
Vigo. He's Vigo.
There's a lot of weird stuff.
We like the buzzing of flies, do you?
We like the buzzing of flies, do
you? I wanted to see more about this bookstore. I like the idea of Ray owning an occult bookstore.
So what's...
And that kind of it's like he belongs on freaking Diagon Alley. Like he's sending Frog's Wart.
I wonder, is that a potential storyline where it's basically like behind the music, where are they now version of Ghostbusters, where Egon has a bookstore and...
Well, that's what they're doing.
I guess that is what they're doing.
They've gone their separate ways, which again is just like... You know, it doesn't make any sense to me that's what's happened in the last 5 years. Unless we explain better why, you know, if they had a falling out amongst themselves, I could maybe buy it. You know, maybe they got so successful that there was a big, you know, they split like the Beatles, you know, they couldn't do anything else.
Bankman went off to do a solo
album. Yeah. Who's Yoko? Exactly.
Yeah. Sigourney Weaver has to be Yoko.
But the other thing is
I'm going to say Rick Moranis was Yoko.
Yeah, that's true.
Somehow he broke that.
You know, and surely he's going to be here any second, right?
Oh, he'll be here.
He
doesn't come back until the courtroom scene.
The sad thing about this movie, sad in a good way, sort of, is that there are individual parts of it that are very, very funny. It does at least
the courtroom scene is hilarious, especially with Rick
this
Moranis.
Is kind of an Incredibles thing because they're doing their you know, underground investigation
underground
and it's illegal.
Like,
they're not supposed to be doing this, but they're doing it anyway.
But now see, I could buy starting here if the reason for them being in this place was the fact that once we defeated the big bad, there wasn't enough business to keep us in business anymore. I could buy that.
I like what
we were talking about earlier, where there's all these competitors now.
Right.
I like that as a potential storyline too. But
that's actually not a bad approach. I've never really considered that, but that's actually a good idea. That the reason they had their big heyday was because of the amped up paranormal activity.
Right.
So once they defeated it, there are no more ghosts to bust.
Right.
The paranormal activity goes away.
But there's no economy of scale. There's not enough to pay the overhead.
It seemed pretty clear.
That would have been a fine... I think that would have been a much stronger way to do it.
It seemed pretty clear that it predated Gozer, though. Like, they'd been researching this stuff for a while, the library ghost and stuff like that. So it wasn't just Gozer.
Now, I
have to say, the Ghostbusters video game... Which has come out since
Can I borrow that from you?
Yeah.
Not to get personal business on the podcast, but yeah.
The Ghostbusters video game, I think, as I did a whole review on it on my blog, but it has a really good storyline, and it actually relates to the first one, like it's a continuation of kind of the Gozer thing.
Oh, really?
Which is interesting, and actually, like, thinking about it, like, it works great in the video game because then you get to kind of – it's justifications for replaying the movie while still having a new story, basically. But somehow manages to not be as much of a retread of the movie – the first one as this one is. Like, I'm not sure I would have liked that. I'm not
You mean?
On the screen, well, I would have accepted any damn thing they threw at me, as we obviously have noticed. But like looking back at it now, I'd probably still have complaints and be like, there it's not Gozer. Like, it's not Ghostbusters versus Gozer. It's Ghostbusters versus the paranormal, the supernatural, you know, come up with something else. But Viggo's not enough, you know, is the problem.
Now, the review for the video game is on your website. It's on dorkmanscott.wordpress.com.
You can just find it by dorkmanscott.com.
Is there like a tag on your blog all about Ghostbusters?
I should have one, yeah. I should establish one.
Should have one.
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing I was going to say is, so we've basically established that this is a
I love this baby. I always thought this baby was adorable.
And is it
one that's slightly... Yeah, it's twins. Yeah. And you can tell because one of them is slightly cuter than the other.
One is so much smarter than the other.
I have to say.
At least you said that you put the shine on it and say one of them's kind of uglier than the other.
Yeah.
So we've established that, A, this is... not necessarily a failure, but it's not a success of a sequel. And B, that this is more along the lines of an episodic franchise than a saga franchise. So what separates Indiana Jones' world from Ghostbusters' world in terms of how you can make successful sequels? Because is it just that...
The Indiana Jones sequels are worth telling. This is not a particularly compelling story that they've come
up
with.
Yeah, it's not a particularly... But at the same time...
Well, is that built into the universe?
At the same time, no, here's the real problem. Here's the real problem, because I feel like as long as you get the character right, it doesn't matter what the story is, which is why the new Indiana Jones didn't work. But I feel like the and Bill Murray had the same complaint. Like, the reason we haven't had a Ghostbusters 3 in such a long time, number one, I'm sure, is money. But number two is Bill Murray didn't want to do it because he had such a miserable time doing Ghostbusters 2 because it was the kind of – like, and he's talked about it in interviews because people have asked him about Ghostbusters 3. And finally, earlier this this year at a convention, I don't remember which one, doing a thing for City of Ember, he got a Ghostbusters 3 question. And he's like, you know what? I think I might do it. Like, he's like – I think the wounds from Ghostbusters 2 have healed. And he explained it. He was like, basically, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, but he basically said, you know, the first one was so much fun to do because it was just us riffing off each other and stuff like that, and it was a fun story and stuff like that. And then we came along to the second one. We had a huge budget, and the effects guys got the script. They got a hold of the script before we did, and they got a hold of Ivan, basically, and they were basically, you know, and it was in the headier days of, you know, in the 80s with lots of money, and they were like, oh, dude, we could do this and this and this and this, and Ivan is just like, yeah.
And as previously established, everybody was on coke.
Right, exactly.
Because it was the 80s.
So it was complete, so it was the kind of thing where he's like, they got the script, and it was just gone. Like, and then it was us just kind of marching through the scenes until the next effect.
Yeah.
And so he's like I love these characters, and it was such a waste of everything to just go and do that and just be.
It's always really charming when you hear the actor say that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's the kind of thing where I heard I'm sorry to keep cutting you off, but
movie.
Yeah.
Bill
Murray agreed to do Ghostbusters 3 finally cuz he went back and did the video game, like cuz at one point,
and he said it was so much fun.
When TMNT came out, the fucking animated movie, Dan Aykroyd, who's been trying to get Ghostbusters, like, he's the one been carrying the torch, right? And he was like, oh, we should totally do Ghostbusters 3 that way. And everyone's like, no, don't do it that way. But Bill Murray said, you know what, if you did, I would do Venkman. I would come back and do the voice. So then a couple years later, they're going to do the video game. They actually, like, someone's just going to do the video game, but then Aykroyd and Ramis find out, and they're like, we love that idea. And they actually got involved with the writing and stuff like that, and they wanted to, and so they went to Bill Murray and they were like, you said you'd do your voice. If you had, so he came back and he did it, and he was like, I loved it, like, I missed those characters and I missed doing it, and he was saying, I found myself, like, I was walking down the street fucking whistling the theme, and people are looking at me like, this guy,
wow, he's
you're an asshole.
He's just like that. He's still needed.
So he was like, I think I would do Ghostbusters 3, and something that made me really, I mean, I already loved him, of course, but made me really like him was his one stipulation at this point for doing Ghostbusters 3 was, if I'm going to do Ghostbusters 3, Winston has to be a better character.
Oh, nice. There you go.
You have to write a better character for Winston.
Good for him. Well played, Bill Murray.
Yeah.
You mean the black guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Trey, what were you going to say 20 minutes ago?
I was going to say that clearly the only time that in this movie that that Murray is having fun is in the scenes when they're just in a normal building or a room or on the street, and he gets to just do the Bill Murray thing.
Just riffing.
And he's riffing. You know, it's like just when you hire Bill Murray, you know, you can bother to show him the script if you want to, but yeah. But usually you hire Bill Murray to show up and be Bill Murray. And just
Bill, in this scene, you're trying to convince him of this. Just go.
Yep.
Yeah, just go.
And just
go.
Be hysterically funny and go with it. I mean, you know, famously in Tootsie, I mean, you know, virtually everything he does in Tootsie, which is a movie he also steals half of, you know, everything he says in the entire movie is pretty much improvised. So you also notice that in this movie, whether by contractually or by just orchestration, that Murray manages to miss as much of the visual effects participation as he possibly can. He doesn't participate at all in this slime.
Yo,
doesn't participate at all in this sliming scene. He doesn't get covered with slime at all ever in this movie.
That
whereas the
back
other guys
to what you
get
said based on the
drenched, and you know he literally is like he's almost sort of only peripherally in this movie.
This new thing was neat. The Geiger meter. Anyway,
he's only
he's
barely in this movie at all. He's sort of like walking. He literally is walking through and avoiding as much of the rest of the stuff as he possibly can.
It's funny because in the first one, you were talking about how you had this theory based on having worked with that gooey stuff where it's like, I think Bill Murray touched it once and said,
yeah,
what, not I'm
not me.
Getting slimed ever again.
And certainly, you know, he's even doesn't get very slimed in the first movie. This movie, literally, the other guys get dosed head to toe, which had to be miserable. And he
That's
doesn't get
stuff.
Hit at all. So here's one of the more compelling, you know, interesting scenes in the movie,
yeah.
And none of the Ghostbusters are in it. That's a problem when your supposed lead characters are not in the good scenes.
Oh, man. And I love that he's just like, I'm not even sure he's been, like, magically taken over. He's just immediately like, all right, are the lord of the universe.
Yeah. Was he always like that? Maybe he was just always willing to, if someone showed up and said, I'm in charge.
But, you know, it's funny.
Oh,
it's
yes,
funny.
Sir.
I don't know if this aligns with you guys, but as a skeptic, I see that, and it's like, I'm looking at a painting, and all of a sudden a face is talking to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, have I taken PCP today?
Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
It's immediately enough evidence for me to go, something's going on.
I'm behind you, whatever you're doing. To be fair, exactly.
I'm like, I'm going to do whatever the painting wants me to do,
yeah.
As long as the painting is talking to me. And then I'm going to leave the room with the painting and call someone and be
yeah.
like, all right, some shit just
But then it's like, who
That's
do you
cool
call?
Stuff.
Ghostbusters.
Hey, that's good we're in this movie.
As a skeptic, I would kind of go, well, before I immediately leap into worshiping the painting,
right.
I will examine some other possible
No, exactly. No, I would tell the painting I'm worshiping it just
oh, yeah.
in case.
Just to get out of the room.
Yeah.
That's what I usually do.
But then, like, you know, try and bring other people in, be like, all right,
go talk to this painting.
Yeah. First of all, I had this really weird experience. Yeah, let's talk about as skeptics, what do you do if that happens to you? like you have to assume, the first assumption is that you are in some fashion deluded.
Yeah,
the first
thing I think is that someone slipped me something.
Yeah, you have had a hallucination. So how do you determine whether or not you're actually dealing with an evil painting that
camera,
wants to
video
take your
camera.
Soul?
Yeah.
Video camera. Okay, that's one way to do it.
Now this is another one of my pet peeves about
River
this movie.
Slime.
This is an amazing.
This terrified me as a child.
Oh, man.
It's an amazing scene. It's an amazing set. It's beautiful. It's extremely
crazy
expensive.
Oils and waters
it's,
and paint.
It's beautiful,
and, stuff.
And it's just about completely unnecessary.
Right.
This scene has no purpose in this plot.
This action, no, but the river of slime is necessary to. This
yeah, but
plot,
it's at this price, it's
right.
It's
and
really
it was,
just
the. It was almost the subtitle. In fact, it was also most Ghostbusters River of Slime.
Yeah,
but. That this train station actually apparently really exists.
It doesn't look like that, but
the old pneumatic system
was the original attempt to make a subway in New York.
Unregulated attempt to make.
Yeah,
a subway.
It was a private citizen
yeah.
who literally dug his own tunnel.
There was something like that in L.A. too. That like now
yeah.
we have a metro, but at some point like in the 30s
yeah,
there was
no,
a
we
subway
don't.
In L.A.
Well, there was the
and it was like this
the red car, the red car.
It was a wonderful setup, and then it just I don't remember what it was, but I read a
Judge Doom.
Yeah, Judge Doom bought
it.
Judge Doom bought it.
Tire lobby.
Cloverleaf Industries bought it. The tunnel. Some of the tunnels are still there. You know, under some.
You've seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit, right? He just gave me this blank look when I said that.
Not enough times to know what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay,
that's the whole.
It's easy to not notice that part when you're. Yeah, young.
However,
and just
I did just
cartoons.
Read an article comparing Who Framed Roger Rabbit to the source story, which is apparently completely different.
Who censored Roger Rabbit, which is similar in some things, but definitely a very different
yeah,
story.
Yeah, there was also I saw a script for the sequel at one point. I didn't get
for
to
Who Framed
read it.
Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, it was going to be Who Killed Roger Rabbit.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Who shot Roger Rabbit?
Roger Rabbit died in the
like
original
that.
Book.
Yeah.
Yeah. He'd been dead the whole book. In fact, spoiler, he'd been dead.
Oh, Towers.
He'd been the whole book. And
Who Said to Roger Rabbit? It's about him.
A copy of himself had been had been doing it. But there was about five leaps there we made there, but the Pacific Electric or whatever. Yeah, there used to be a subway, and there's still pieces of tunnels under some of the – it went right through downtown, what is now downtown, with the skyscrapers. So a lot of skyscrapers were built, and their foundations cut the tunnels. But there are still chunks of those tunnels under downtown, and you can still access some of them. And the exit used to be – I think it's been built over finally just a few years ago. But for years, the exit was right by the Bob Baker Marionette Theater where I used to work, where it came out from underground and became a trolley car. And that sat there abandoned for decades.
Is that
the
thing from Speed?
It's not in Speed, but you see it all the time in lots of movies. They used to use that tunnel entrance for all kinds of movies.
I don't
recall. MacArthur, they used it as a bunker for the Japanese or something.
I don't recall Speed very vividly, mind you, but I remember there was a sequence where he gets back onto the subway with Dennis Hopper, and then the thing leaps out of the street.
Yeah, but that's the new subway. This is a long abandoned.
I don't take the subway. I got
subway.
A car. This is Los Angeles. What do you want from me?
Thank God for the Metro Rail.
I love Janosch's really artless. Like, all right, this is my first attempt at stealing the baby. Like, this is the only baby I know of. I'm going to try and get this baby. So he just kind of shows up.
He's sort of in his own other movie Ghostbusters are only barely in.
This is completely a different movie, practically.
Yeah. I feel like I'm being
robbed. And the funny one.
This is interesting because I always thought that this was just like a thing, like a practical thing, but this is apparently all comped.
Including the actual light on the wall?
Including the light on the wall.
Well done, guys.
Nice.
I feel like I'm being robbed of his accent. What's he doing with his voice?
Huh?
He has one of those unplaceable.
He's one of these.
Strange accent.
It's a very Borat
kind
of accent.
The neighborhood, and you know, because all this blackness.
And they make a joke where they say, "Well, where are you from exactly?" And he goes,
"The Upper
West Side."
Upper West Side. Yeah.
So right on cue, finally, we're going to get Rick Moranis.
That's
because
like the short circuit.
We're doing the same movie again.
It's like the short circuit thing about the Indian guy. Where are you from? Oh, Philadelphia originally. No, your family. Oh, Scranton.
Yeah.
So they literally brought everyone back for the big Ghostbusters 2 cavalcade?
Including Slimer, which we'll get to in a bit.
Doesn't Slimer become like a big deal?
Yes, because of the cartoon. The cartoon came out, and Slimer, originally the Onion Head Ghost, he became their pet because he was popular, and they called him Slimer. And so in this one, because the cartoon and the original movie were so popular with the kiddos, they put Slimer in, and he and Lewis, like, they're
I love this little bit.
They
here.
Have a little shtick.
Yeah. He and Lewis had a B plot that ended up getting cut.
And Slimer was in the first Ghostbusters movie, was a very soft, just, he was a hunk of rubber that a guy kind of put his arms up inside, and he was just very squishy and very Muppety, very Cookie Monster. In this
one time I turned into
a dog and they helped me. Yeah. Thank you.
I love the cut to the judge. His reaction shot is priceless.
In this one, Slimer is, when you finally see him, he's done exactly the wrong way.
Very good, Lewis.
Slimer is done with a hard armature with lots of little cable toggles underneath, so he's a very static, stiff statue with rubber on top that kind of wiggles in different ways.
Oh, he's very articulated, though.
It's completely awful. It's terrible compared to, you know, when
Meanwhile, original
he used to
Slimer.
Be a huge, big, floppy hunk of foam rubber that would squish and stretch and do all kinds of things. Yeah. And this one, he's very clearly, look, we can do our animated eyebrow wiggles, which everyone was very into doing in those days.
Yeah. There's actually, I'll post it in the blog. I'll find the link. But someone who worked on Ghostbusters 2 has actually was taking videos of behind the scenes stuff, like really rare and not, you know, no commentary or anything, just fly on the wall stuff for when they were shooting the ghost plates. Like, so he's got a video of testing the Slimer puppet, like just inside of a, like in a shop. Someone is wearing the Slimer puppet and they have her. Because it's a girl, you know, a small girl, and it's a giant thing because they then later scale it down. But kind of practicing this one motion over and over to try and sync like the expression to what she's doing and stuff like that, and it's really cool. And they also have the shooting of the Scolari brothers, who we're going to see show up in a little bit.
The Scolari brothers,
yeah,
as in Peter,
huh?
Yeah. What? As in Peter Scolari?
No. Tony and Nuncio Scolari are
Whoa,
their names.
Nice.
God damn, Michael Dorfman Scott with the win!
Tony is the skinny one and Nuncio is the fat one.
Nuncio's prettier.
Yeah. For those who needed to know
If anyone needed to know which was which, Tony and Nuncio. But But he's got – they've got – and I have to say it's not like I could have just pulled that out of my ass like 10 years ago. Like they are actually labeled on the YouTube site because it shows them shooting both of them, Tony Scaleri plates, Nuncio Scaleri plates. I did know that before then, but I could have gotten it from them.
I can't tell if you're offending or defending your honesty. I can't tell if you're like, I'm cool because I used to know that, or I'm cool because I know that now, or I'm not cool because I used to know that, not cool because I know that now.
Yeah. And I read the Cinefex, but
yeah, there you go. There was a cutaway there to the courtroom audience that was sort of like the central casting cross section of New York from 1989. It was like they have one of every type of New Yorker all in the same courtroom.
I love
for
this.
Some strange reason.
Of course, this is the needed line. Sometimes shit happens. Someone has to deal with it, and who you're going to call? Now, they use that in the trailer, but they change it to sometimes bad things happen.
That's right.
I heard and you know they shot one take in particular for the trailer.
Yeah. You know, for
oh,
kids.
Of course.
I had a theory. And for TV. I heard a theory that the most funny comic actor is basically waiting for a scenario where he can be himself in a perfect scenario, where here's the number of things that you've prepared something funny to say about. How would you will yourself out of this situation?
Uh-huh.
And that's and it plays immediately into my understanding of Venkman from Ghostbusters 1. Where
this
it's
has
like,
good tension, by the way, the sequence. This building
the way it's building.
Ghostbusters 1 has this feeling of this is Bill Murray at his on his best day in a real situation.
Right.
So it makes me think at some point in his life, Bill Murray's been pretty close to this just trying to get out of a parking ticket.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I mean, you look at – the problem is this movie – it's almost like you want this movie to be carried away by Bill Murray, and he's hardly in it. Like Ghostbusters 1 works so well because of Bill Murray, and this one he's kind of just stands there and nods and smiles half the time. But this is a great intro of these characters because you're like
– Statler? What?
You're finally seeing ghosts again, and you're
Marley
like, holy
and
shit.
Marley.
And I like the performance. They come back being electrocuted. Now, this is interesting because, of course, they were just on wires, so they just kind of did this action stationary, and then when they comped it, they did all the animation of them flying around and stuff like that.
So I tried the promoter.
They're also
gave
very,
them the chair.
Yeah, they're very large. The suits and everything are very big, and so are the ghosts. They're like 12 feet tall. And this was actually a really big sequence. And reading about it in Cinefex helped make it clear what was going on, because this was a movie that kind of like the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels. They were making up as they went along, and it went through a lot of changes. And it was the kind of thing like those costumes. The
under restrangement order. Sorry.
Judicial restrangement order. The Scaleri brothers are actually very articulated to the point where they could do lip sync, like because they were going to be just kind of cussing out the Ghostbusters in Italian, and there was this whole crazy sequence where they become like 20 feet tall and be stomping on all the shit and stuff like that. Like, and it got down to this thing where they just kind of fly around and go, and it's like this incredible waste of money and resources because they just kept adjusting things as they went. By the way, speaking of Winston from earlier, he has apparently fled the scene.
Yeah.
Wait.
He was here. He informed them that the guy's name is the Hammer, and he has run for his life.
He's not even in the scene anymore.
That's an excellent point. That's not anything I ever noticed before.
And by the way, his fists are not the Hammer.
Yeah.
Right. But
it could well be, again, at the factor of, like you were saying, that this whole scene was sort of like, well, anyway, when we're shooting it, there may have been a whole reason why he's not there anymore that's no longer in the cut because it was just
I
dropped.
Love Del Rey Egon. I do.
No.
But again, this gets,
I love his smile.
Yeah, this almost gets back to the idea of this being the same movie over again.
It is.
Winston wasn't there when they beat Slimer, obviously he's not going
we've
to
we've seen
be
this
there.
Scene already. This is the banquet room scene. We've seen them do this.
And this is actually, like watching it again after I read the Cinefex, I just watched this and saw the YouTube stuff. I watched the Scaleri scene in particular. And it's actually not much of a scene. Like it's pretty short.
In terms of effects?
In terms of like
it's huge
everything.
In terms of effects, but it's just... It's another scene to me that feels like, well, it's a lot of sound and fury signifying very little.
Yeah, yeah. Because this is it. They come out, they yell, and then they come back out, and then they rope them and just
there's
trap
just,
them.
It's another scene that's kind of like, well, you know when they had... then they
And there's no damage,
ghosts,
by the way. They were just protoning all over the place, and there was
no
damage to
anything. Ghosts in the first movie, that was cool, right? So we'll do that again.
Yeah.
It was cool, Trey, and they should do it again.
It was,
that's all there is
you
to
know,
it.
Michael, the more I think about it, the more I think that this movie could have kept almost exactly the same construction, but it would have been more...
I love Lewis. He just, no! He just runs for his life.
More satisfying if we had gone from the point of... I still like the idea. I think this is the first retcon of Ghostbusters 2 that I've heard that actually might have made this movie work better.
And Ray is completely useless. You got it! Thanks. Yeah. That's an as-you-know if ever we saw one.
The idea of the reason that they stopped being Ghostbusters was because they defeated Gozer, and therefore there was no more paranormal activity. Everything that happens then makes so much more sense to me character-wise. Right. Then, you know, Venkman would have traded on his fame and gotten a TV show. So-and-so would have opened a cult bookstore.
Sure.
So-and-so would have gotten a grant and done creepy, weird research, and they would have gone their separate ways because there was no more ghost to bust. And then this gets them back together, and now for the first time they have to put the packs on. You know, that all would have been so much more satisfying, you know, if that was the setup. Without this phony, we forgot 5 years ago that there was a giant marshmallow man on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
So therefore, what is the failing of Ghostbusters 2?
Just that point, almost.
The fact just that there's no motivation for what we see on the movie?
They don't justify the motivation.
They didn't have a story. They didn't have a script. And as Michael was just explaining, even scenes, they were like, what happens in the scene? Well, if you don't know what happens in the scene, it's because you don't know what your movie's about.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the scene doesn't need to be in the movie. So if they're just like, well, maybe maybe this guy will do this and he'll say that, and you know, then it just means you don't know what movie you're making, and that's going to lead to a poorer result.
Yeah.
Was that a trailer shot just
once
then?
Back. By the way, I hate
the logo.
I hate the fact that they use, like,
and why
like,
do they have it?
I'm all for use it for marketing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
for,
yeah.
Why for they have posters it on their vehicle. And stuff like that, but why the Ghostbusters are like, this is our logo?
Yeah.
There's no reason.
Before that same conversation I was having I remember distinctly having a parking lot in conversation in the parking lot at Steve Johnson's on the Abyss when we found out that the logo for Ghostbusters, we'd seen the Ghostbusters 2 logo,
right.
But then we found out they were actually putting it on the new
on the
ambulance
Exo.
And we immediately went, what?
Yeah.
You know, we were disappointed before we even saw the movie.
That's one of those things where you realize even before the movie comes out, things are just
right. This is not sounding good.
Yeah, they're not quite
getting this. Are there often circumstances, I don't know if you guys have experience with this, circumstances where you can kind of tell based on like one just extraneous piece of information about a movie that's in production?
This is where I know this guy from, by the way. I've seen him since, not these two obviously, but, and this is a reference to a scene that was cut from the original Ghostbusters with this couple in a hotel finding Slimer and dealing with him. This guy. This is Ghostbusters 2.
Also done lots of stuff. Yeah, he's a Walter Peck.
Are there often a chance when you're just finding out extraneous pieces of information about a movie in production where you go, oh, that's not going to work?
Now, yes. I hear they are running a red light, which comes from later, actually. The running a red light and reactions comes from a little bit later after they've examined the Vigo painting, but I'll talk about that.
Because
I read the novelization.
Oh, there you go.
But it was similar to in the first Ghostbusters, the bit with the floating ghost who fellates Ray. There he is.
Yeah, and this is a so much less good Slimer than in the original movie.
Yeah.
Because he's so obviously rigid with you know, creep cable stuff going on.
Yeah, wow.
Can't even close his damn mouth.
Yeah, there was a whole subplot where he was trying to trap Slimer himself. Like he was so focused on doing it, so that has a payoff later when he's like, "Fuck it, I'm a Ghostbuster."
And again, it's like we've seen this. They did this exact same montage in the first movie. It's the good times montage of look, we're trapping ghosts and we're on TV, and even a clip of her watching them on TV is part of that same montage.
Here we go.
Now this is one of the few scenes that actually is fun and makes sense, you know, is important to the story.
I love that.
And is actually a fun little scene. It's a great little scene.
I love the dancing toaster.
Yeah.
I love the things that Egon says to it.
Yes, his version of an insult.
Unstable short-chained molecule. A weak electrochemical bond. And watch his face after he says it. I'm like, yeah, I got it.
Oh, yeah. Told that thing. Yes, you've been told.
Yeah, and they're like, whoa, Scolari. Stop. So that's it. I mean, this is, you know, we've actually gotten into what the story is.
Yeah, we're now 40 minutes in, and the movie is now essentially
starting.
Is where we could have skipped, if we wanted to, we could have skipped all of that. They're not Ghostbusters anymore. This could have been just the beginning of the new, you know,
I love this
morning at the Ghostbusters.
I love this bit where he comes onto it and has the negative reaction. Like, the slime is like, I'll scream rape.
It touched me. It touched me in my slimy part.
And yeah, the toaster is fun.
The toaster is fun and a great little bit of mechanical animation. Yeah.
Although you do see the little
piston.
Well,
sure, you see the little pistons. You can't not see the pistons. But
so is what they're doing now going to pay off later? Is there some bad guy that they get away with by just singing lullabies to it and stuff like that?
Yes, actually.
Yeah, this is actually plot. Finally, for a change, we're seeing a plot thing that we need to know. This component of the plot, the whole idea of the slime and the negative vibrations and so on.
I'll give it that.
It works fine.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's setting up for some good comedy.
Yeah. That's a
perfectly serviceable one magic bean concept.
Yeah, and, yeah. The payoff
especially
is,
for the 80s.
This is the basis of the plot that
right.
can work.
Yeah.
Right.
In a movie that's about Ghostbusters, I mean, you pretty much can assume that the supernatural is a given. And here they are establishing something, and they're going to play by the rules of it later, that it responds to emotion, which right now, predominantly in New York, is negative, so negative right. things are happening in New
and
York.
Obviously, New York is known for its negative emotions.
Yeah, apparently so. So
I almost wonder, like, just Bill Murray's reaction is so almost genuine there. Like, I'm like, did they tell him what was going to happen with the toaster? Because he's just looking at it like, what?
Yeah, he probably would have known because there's a guy under that table at the other end of that cable. But that's the kind of thing you live for in the prop shop, is to get to make...
Whoa.
Is to get to make, you know, a prop like that. It's like, I'm going to make a toaster that, you know, can leap and dance and spit toast.
Would that last shot have been on string? Because he clearly lifts it off the table and there's nothing underneath.
Oh, no, there's the little feet on it
magnets?
Are little pistons. No, they're little pistons that just shoot out.
Oh, so it's just a little RC
setup. And go pew, 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 pew.
Oh, that's cool.
You can see it.
And it's got a very, very thick, thicker cable than most toasters have coming out of it. So it might even be pneumatic for all we can tell. But
that's true, yeah.
So, you know, like I said, as they go, you don't have to hide it. You just build it. You just don't have to hide any tricks.
I do like this bit. This is a good little bit.
Yeah. Bassmasters. Yeah, I know Bassmasters. Yeah, sure.
You and Bassmasters, man. Yeah. Watch those all the time.
Even
that's a moment he was like, I was Maury Povich. My God.
Yeah. even to the point of...
That's a nice moment.
You know, running out of having weird ideas and just like sort of arbitrarily... You know, Dana, the concert cellist... is working at the art museum restoring art.
Yeah.
Because, because she is.
They need to get her the fuck in there for the painting.
Maybe even more so than anything else. That one thing seems like something that changed in the treatment process of the first movie.
Yeah.
She's arty of some sort. She's a violinist. She's a curator. She's something.
From my understanding of, and especially looking at a lot of behind the scenes footage and stuff like that, a lot of the stuff with the painting, especially when the painting moves, is actually a weird kind of forced perspective where it's actually the dude in front of a backdrop and just kind of the way they framed
just
it.
Just angled
and,
the right way.
Angled the right way to look like it was just a flat painting.
Mm. Yeah, so here once again, Peter McNichol is going to kind of steal a scene from Bill Murray, and that is not easy to do.
He shakes everything about him.
That
is
so
amazing.
Not easy to do to be on screen with Bill Murray and hold your own. It kind of makes me wonder if there was a draft. Was there a draft before Sigourney Weaver finally agreed to do this? Where they're like, yeah, so there's a new chick and she works in the art. You know, there's a whole painting subplot we've got going on. So the new love interest is going to be this girl who works in the. Oh, Sigourney's available? Oh, then let's make her the girl in the art.
Oh, man.
Then.
You know, I bet.
I have no idea, but it feels like that.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That explains pretty much.
And we'll just
everything.
Explain why she isn't
with
a
him,
concert jealous anymore and why they're not together.
And why they're not together. Exactly. No, I bet you're probably right. That probably was how it was.
Sigourney's on the phone again. Okay, 2 million. Click.
Yeah.
A week later. Okay, 3 million, Sigourney. Click. 4 million?
Okay.
Ding, we got to stay up.
Well, you work at the museum now.
That's right.
Just so you know.
Your character is totally different. You're pregnant and you have to act as if you've never met Bill Murray before.
Yeah.
So it's like a new character.
This is good timing, too. He's like, something weird's going on with the painting, and then they turn around and I'm not with them.
What if five years later? This is basically, it's taking the same sort of general direction as this one, but it's an extension of it.
When I first watched this movie, I had to go pee right at this point, so I actually didn't know this scene was in the movie until, like, my second viewing.
This is another scene that terrified me as a child.
You don't want a bathtub that eats babies is a scary idea.
What if there was some sort of a global paranormal cosmic event going on where 5 years later they're all in different places. One of them lives in Portland. One of them is doing field work in Czechoslovakia, and like there's like all these people. And then at some point, one day, something happens that causes them all to have to deal with paranormal stuff at one point, and they kind of get in communication with the other and goes, something huge is going on right now. And it's more of a statement. I mean, it's basically this movie says they're five.
I'll put this out there. That would be a much better stinger than this one has. That would be a much better pre-title
hook. What do you mean stinger?
A hook right at the beginning.
That moment where everyone is dealing with their own thing on various places.
The first two pages, and then just there, we see a couple things happening, and then some fucked up shit happens, and then the theme song kicks in.
Now,
like that moment. But go ahead.
Isn't that how the movie starts? Well, I mean, how is that different?
I'm saying his version of it, where it's something that happens in freaking Belize.
It's literally
and
a global
South Africa
thing.
And stuff. Whoa. Simultaneously.
Is this how you take care of your baby?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Yeah. Depending on what you're going to do with it at the time. But if you're going
to... Now, the problem with that, though, is as much as Ghostbusters are paranormal...
Now, this is very much recycled blob technology. Not the best comp there. No. This is recycled blob technology. This is pretty much a lot of the stuff we had just done the year before on the blob, and a lot of the same techniques being used.
What the hell is this?
I mean, as much as these are movies about ghosts and paranormal, they're also New York movies. So... They're as much about New York as they are about ghosts.
Yeah, I think
so you can't do what you do with Indiana Jones. We're like, okay, this one will be in Asia and this one will be in South America. Yeah. As for them to be Ghostbusters movies, they still have to be in New York.
Yeah, taking Ghostbusters out of the way would have been a
problem. Well, they could come back to New York on page 10.
It's true. You could do something like that, but to... I just don't understand how
if they're geographically separated, what that brings to the story. I mean, they already are separated. They're still in the same city, how the story starts already.
He's saying just that, I understand correctly, it's just upping the stakes in terms of the scope. It's like, it's something so big that it didn't just happen in New York, it happened everywhere. The epicenter's in New York.
The more I think about it, the more that seems like a Roland Emmerich film.
It does. What sort of films has Roland Emmerich made lately?
I'm totally fine with if the Ghostbusters had shown up in 2012.
Ghostbusters 2012.
All is forgiven.
I see they were having us on the whole time.
Yeah.
John Cusack just comes to a stop. The Ghostbusters, yeah. And the music swells, and there they are, and it's like, oh, it's all.
Although I have to say, the cameo in Casper, not happy with that.
Okay, now wait a second.
You know why? Because he ran away. Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
I've never watched all of Casper.
You don't have to. It's in the first 10 minutes. You're like, I made it two, okay?
Yeah. I've never deliberately watched it at all, so I've never seen the beginning.
They moved into the mansion, right? The Casper mansion, and there's ghosts. So they're trying to do everything they can, and they've got Father Guido Sarducci goes in there and tries to do an exorcism. Like, there's a bunch of references to characters, right? But at one
Is the atomic weight of cobalt 58.9? Sorry.
No. Quoting. They rounded.
Yes.
But at one point, Dan Aykroyd, in kind of inexplicably with a mustache, comes running out of the house because it was clearly just a one-day cameo, and they were like, hey, we know you like squirreled away this equipment and stuff like that because you're obsessed like I am. But so can you come out and just do a one-day thing as a Ghostbuster? So he's like, yeah, fuck it, sure. So at one point he comes running out of the house with his proton pack on and stuff. He's like, who are you going to call? Someone else. And then walks off. And I was like, fucking Ghostbuster wouldn't run from that shit.
Yeah, what the
Ghostbuster
hell?
Would not put up with a single thing that the Casper ghosts were doing. Like, please. But so I was never – I liked that he showed up, but I was like –
It doesn't fit the character.
That's not right for the character.
It's a joke at the expense of the character.
Yeah,
let's go back
I'm not
for
cool
a second. I feel like this could be really interesting. Let's do a 1.5-minute scriptment session for Ghostbusters 2, starting with, okay, in the first 3 pages, they're on all different countries. They're doing a whole different thing.
Well, I disagree with that. I disagree with that.
Not necessary, but I don't see the point.
What you said is the first note is they have to be in New York. It's a New York movie. So how do we get a movie out of that? How do we get a good Ghostbusters 2 with
the majority
something
of the movie.
Global is happening? Go. What do you got?
Well, why has it got to be global even? I mean, it could almost happen with. I was talking with. I've gone through different ideas for Ghostbusters 3, definitely. But
I mean, Gozer was global. It just centered in New York.
Yeah,
you know, Gozer was presumably not just going to destroy New York. She was going to continue.
You know what you could do to raise the stakes globally, but still keep it in New York?
How's that?
UN? Something at the UN.
There you go. The UN.
There you go.
Tie the UN somehow.
Well, how would they know about the UN though?
Huh?
Well, I mean, is it draining out? Is it draining out bad energy?
Well, no. It could be some worldwide phenomenon thing, but that is still like the center of it, much like that the building in the first one.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's not a bad idea. I mean, just to, you know, we haven't written the script for 6 months and spent 6 months developing it. But the UN also might. You know, that's an area that if you wanted to go with that idea, that, okay, fine, they're the Ghostbusters, and they're not discredited, they're the people who saved New York, but they don't have any power at the UN because of all the diplomatic immunities in the different countries
that's
who go,
good.
We
that's
don't
good.
Believe
that's
in
good.
Your Ghostbusting.
Now, there's a lot of comedy there, too.
Yeah. Here's the idea, which is, I think, actually a good idea, and I should have brought it up before, probably, but the idea for Ghostbusters 3 that's been floating around, the general idea, simply put, in terms of what can you do that's new with these characters, the story in the first one and ultimately the second one is something bad is going to happen. The
just
ghost world isn't the ghost world isn't true. I do love that. The ghost world isn't, and he's I'm going to start that sentence about 20 times, but that's Rasputin. That's very similar to Rasputin.
Very, very much
the way they had to
Rasputin.
Kill him about 20 times.
Right, right, right.
And he would not die.
But the concept for Ghostbusters 3 was, well, what do you do? Well, now the Ghostbusters have to go to the ghost world. Like, they go over
to
the
only thing
other
I've heard about Ghostbusters 3, which I love, is the idea that the George Washington Bridge, I think, the whatever bridge goes into New Jersey has become the bridge to hell.
Right. The concept was Ghostbusters in Hell, and the working title was Ghostbusters Hellbent.
We are so dating this.
Ghostbusters.
But I love the idea of New Jersey being hell, right? Which is obviously very.
But I think
concept.
I think that may be the way to go, like almost the kind of thing where in number one,
you put the Ghostbusters out of their element.
Yeah, and
but
in number
we just said it has to be in New York.
No. Well, it's still New York. It's just the hellish version of New York.
York. It's Newark.
In the first one, they stopped. They stopped the crossover from happening. In the second one, or third one, I guess, they don't get to it soon enough, and the crossover at least starts to happen at some significant level, basically. And they have to try and not only stop it, but also undo it. I wrote a Ghostbusters 2 script 10 years ago. And 11. And a couple of times I thought about doing a new one, and one of the new versions was,
but not many.
Yeah, one of the new versions was this basically City of the Dead shows up in Liberty Harbor essentially, and they're like, and nice. like all these ghosts start swarming, like basically immigrating into New York, and they're like, we can't, like, it's, this isn't just ghosts showing up and we can bust them, like, this is a big thing, so they have to go into the City of the Dead and do something about it. Yeah. But
that sounds almost like mixing MIB with Ghostbusters.
A little bit, yeah, or Super Mario Brothers. But
what?
That was the plot of Super Mario Brothers. They were trying to recombine the two dimensions.
Is there a plot to Super Mario Brothers?
Yes, which we should
as
do that.
As it
movie,
is, there it
way.
Is.
Anyway, that scene that we just saw with him examining the painting, Ray. And he has kind of a moment with the painting. In the original script and in the novelization, and presumably they shot it because portions of it showed up in the montage, basically Ray gets possessed by Vigo straight away
afterwards.
Which
he does briefly at the end.
Which he does briefly at the end, which apparently he's just really susceptible to that. But I guess they cut it out because he starts just driving through red lights and stuff, and they're like, oh, you're being crazy. And he's like, no, I'm being Vigo. And they're like, holy shit. And I don't remember what they do with that. I think he even crashes the car and then comes out of it and is like, oh, well, what happened, guys? I guess they cut that because they're like, we don't really address that again until the end. You'd think they would have locked his ass up and not let him get involved anymore. But he's all over the place in the rest of the story, so I guess they just dropped that.
Hello, Sigourney.
Yeah. Could do a whole scene, you know, moist in a towel. I approve. I approve this message.
And you know how movies are made. This took a whole day. So yeah. Someone's job was to glycerin her the fuck up.
Yeah, it's just pretty cold, I imagine, by the end of this day.
Woo!
So once again, he has to woo her all over again.
Yeah.
She seems fairly open to it at this point. It seems like the wooing has already been taken care of. And again, it wasn't even a struggle. It was like, show up and be Ghostbusters, and okay, now you're all awesome.
Well, okay. I'm sorry. I want to get
back
to this.
I
feel like this is a really cool thing we can do for people that are interested in this. So in terms of continuing on with our UN version of the movie, what makes a sequel work versus its original? Because admittedly, the two sequels that work better than any other in cinema history are Empire and Godfather 2. I don't know Godfather 2 well enough to do this. And Aliens. There you go.
Terminator 2.
Where it's literally just, it's not a redoing, which this is. It's, the story goes on from there. It's not like those people all died the second half of the film.
It's, an extension.
So what happens after
Ghostbusters? It's a story worth telling. And we it still may well be. I mean, the difficulty factor for many movies that are sequels is that they really just shouldn't exist. That's the reason. It's like there's no good story to be told.
That universe just doesn't have another story in it.
Yeah.
I mean,
most good stories are origin stories.
You see a lot of...
Exactly.
I would... actually disagree with that. I don't really I tend to dislike origin stories and be like, all right, you show me where they came from, now show me what they're gonna do.
Well,
show me why they're
it sort of depends because
that works. That's good.
Well, in terms of compelling storytelling, and I've used this line before, is that, you know, in terms of a story that chances are is going to be interesting to watch, becoming is more interesting than being, you know, the story of how Barack Obama became president is so much more interesting than anything that's happened since he became president, even though his presidency has been interesting.
I think what Dorgan was just saying is that origin stories are only our origin stories are fine because they work, but the interesting story is, why were you called to be that? So I guess the question is then, what are the Ghostbusters uniquely qualified
for? It's like we were talking about. It's like we got 40 minutes into this before the plot really got really took off, and it's like, okay, we got the origin story. We don't need the origin story in this one. We know how it works. They've got the proton packs. They go after ghosts and they go in the trap. Great. Now what? You know, start me there.
Yeah.
And that's the movie that
should one of the guys in the stinger capture a ghost? Should one of the guys be like, fuck, and run to the truck and get the thing and capture
all
the
captions
and say that we've got this ghost, let's interrogate him or something?
There's nothing
like that.
Wrong with the construction of this movie. It's the setup. It's the underlying plot. That's, you know, it's fine. It's it opens with, you know, the gotcha.
Wow, that's a hell of a magnifying glass.
It opens with the giant, you know, rock rolling down and trying to crush the hero. It's like, oh my gosh, a baby carriage loose on the streets of New York. It's exactly the same setup as the first one, but that's okay. I mean, it's okay to say the ghosts are back, which is what that sort of says. It's just this underlying justification for why they're not Ghostbusters anymore. This doesn't make any sense to me.
This is a scene that actually made me aware of Pan and Scan, because when they show this, when they would show this on TV,
get rid of
the widescreen, they cut back and forth between them throughout that scene. And I would watch that and go, that's not how that played out.
That's weird. That's not
like
weird.
I don't. And then I'd watch it again. That's when I came to understand.
So they would just jump cut back and forth, left and right in the frame.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's because they were so far apart that you basically
there's
see
no way
them.
To frame
it was,
that.
It was two separate shots essentially. But this was one of the first VHSs released in letterbox format.
Yeah. Hmm. The first movie I ever saw where I was aware of that was Chinatown. Because Chinatown, there's like two people sitting in the back seat of a car, and it's like cut, and it's like it's ugly cutting. You know, it's like that can't be how that was. It's, oh, of course it used to be a widescreen film, and they were just sitting there in the car, the two of them.
The thing about a sequel is it has to do two things. It has to raise the stakes of what you saw in the first movie and justify the raising of those stakes. So you're not just. It's like if we want to talk about 2012. Say we talk about 2012 as a sequel of Independence Day, where the destruction is even greater. The destruction of the Earth is even more so.
Right.
But it's not. Okay,
that's not enough to justify a sequel, because it's like, well, yeah, you can blow up more stuff. That's what sequels usually do.
I mean, the simplest example is, as we said before, you have Alien. Yes. And then there's Aliens.
Right, exactly.
There you go.
That's actually a great example. You're raising the stakes, but then you have to justify it. It was like if instead of Aliens was justified the way it is, if instead Aliens was it's the same ship and a crew that is essentially the same, you know,
gets another alien.
And they get chased by the alien. Yeah.
Exactly.
And here's another thought. I mean, I'll throw this out there to the room, to the think tank. What if Ghostbusters 2 was about how Bill Murray and Dana were together, and therefore he didn't want to go back and have to bust ghosts anymore?
That's a B-plot. That's definitely
as a B-plot, I'm saying, as opposed to them retreading their relationship over again.
Absolutely.
What if the setup
gives us plenty of requisite Murray.
Yeah, and what if the
setup,
was that she, you know, she doesn't want him to, because it's like, well, you know, we have a kid now. We have a kid, and what if you die?
And then we get the fantastic third act break where he's like, you know what, I gotta be
a Ghostbuster.
You know, and she would realize, yes, you do.
Yeah.
You know, that would be the...
But the problem with that is...
Oh my God, that's... That would be so much better.
But the problem with that is you get two acts where Bill Murray is not a Ghostbuster.
True.
Exactly.
And that's a problem.
I don't know if that's a problem, because as long as he's funny, number one, that's cool. Yeah. Number two...
While these guys are learning more and more and keep coming back to him and going blah, blah, blah.
And number two, the whole thing is you're sitting there being like, be a fucking Ghostbuster again. Well, so when he does it...
And the justification is because it's their son that's in jeopardy.
Yeah,
their son is kidnapped their son is the MacGuffin of the whole thing.
Absolutely.
That's why they both have to get on board.
Speaking of a very personal connection...
We've so totally saved this movie. If we just go back in time.
Well, one of the things you're just saying is that one way to justify a sequel is to have the bad guy be bigger, but here's an interesting way. What if
this is
smaller?
A smaller bad guy? Well, he is.
I don't know enough about this movie and this may factor in, because you said that in a cutscene, Aykroyd gets possessed.
Yeah. I love this. They hear the echoes, and then Winston tries to do it, and this is fucking scary.
Whoa!
What if...
No echo,
hang
and
on.
Then...
But yet another... Like,
Winston!
What a fucking freak out. Yeah.
scene that really doesn't go anywhere or have any justification for being in the movie.
Right.
I mean, there's just scary stuff, and then there's a ghost train, but what does it lead to, and what does it mean? It doesn't actually advance the plot in any meaningful way.
What if in our
but
sequel...
You know, it's a scary throwaway scene. Now, I'm not denying that the scene itself works, but you know what movie is it in? I don't know.
What if
they need more
sequel,
of that? It needs more scary in this movie. I think
we explore two interesting themes that have historically worked well in movies. One is the possession of a friend and the intervention theme, and two is the Joss Whedon "we have to convince someone they're wrong, not defeat them" thing, where one of these guys, maybe it's Egon, maybe it's Spengler, that'd be cool. Gets possessed in a situation where
Spengler and Egon are the same, just so you know.
Egon Spengler. Oh, yeah, I was thinking.
He gave a choice, Egon or Spengler.
Egon, stop that! I was thinking it'd be interesting if one of them gets possessed in a way where he's kind of consciously aware while he's being possessed and just disagrees with the Ghostbusters and uses the Ghostbusters' knowledge that he's gained to help see through the cracks of things. And
ooh,
the three guys,
a Picard assimilated by the Borg kind of a thing.
Exactly, where the guys have to figure out not only how to get their friend back, but how to stop this thing that the friend is allowing to happen. Mm-hmm. So facilitating this whole thing, and then maybe, or something like that.
And how to think outside the box of what they've done before in the past.
Because we know what happens when you make the same movie twice, you get Ghostbusters 2. So right. In this universe where we have already seen Ghostbusters 2 and are writing Ghostbusters 2, we want to avoid Ghostbusters 2.
Right. I think it's you know, it's very true. You want to raise the stakes. I mean, we just said this, or I just said this movie needs more scary. It needs more scary. It needs more funny. It needs more action. Like, it needs more,
ghosts.
Of everything. More ghosts. Way more ghosts. Ooh. My goodness. Like, we hardly even... We see them bust...
Did you catch the number on that locomotive? Yeah. Sorry. I missed it.
Boy, Ernie Hudson...
Like, seriously, how often do they bust out the proton packs? We see them use it against the Scolari brothers.
Yeah, why didn't they even bring them? They're looking for ghosts down here. Why don't they bring them? But the... Boy, Winston... boy, Ernie Hudson was perilously close to doing a 1920s, you know...
Blackface kind of thing.
Booga, booga, booga. Oh, I do believe in spooks. They might be spooks down there.
Although they do reference, they're like, we should get the proton packs.
Yeah, it's
like,
how about that for an idea?
Wow, now that you mentioned that, I remember thinking at the time, that thought occurred to me. I was like, why did they not? They're so scary. There's so much danger. And they don't have
bring their proton packs.
They don't even have their PKE out, for God's sake. I mean, that you know, that's the kind of thing. It's like they seem to have forgotten how I mean, that's the main thing. It's like you come back in and you want to see, all right, these guys have a system. They get how this works now. They've got the PKE out and they know how to, you know, how to read it and blah, blah,
There's
blah,
a learning
blah.
Curve involved and they're at this point.
They're at this point and then something happens where they're like, like there's the big bad, like there's raising the stakes. They're like, we get this up to this level.
Right.
This is way
this
beyond.
This guy is so far above where we are at.
Yeah. Which would be hard to do with Viggo, even though I kind of do, like, I've never had a huge complaint with Viggo because I'm like, well, if you're not going to do Gozer, what else are you, like, it's got to be some big bad. There's a villain.
I've never had a problem with Gozer either, with Viggo either, but I always assumed that was just because I grew up with it.
Yeah,
and,
but
you know,
but
it's just grandfather clause for
me. Is, yeah, exactly. He is smaller than a god, though, although he could be a god. Like, the idea is that he becomes a god.
But no one asked.
He's like, they defeated, last time they defeated, you know, Zeus, and this time they're fighting Hitler, basically.
Right,
Ghost
right.
Hitler. It's like, it's just, it's not as big
Ghost
a deal.
Hitler.
Ghost
at
Hitler.
At the UN.
At the UN.
Oh my God.
There you go.
A lot of
there
people,
you go.
A lot of people have since suggested something like Cthulhu for Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
that could be cool.
Yeah,
well,
there was a lot of Lovecraftian elements and even an episode called Collect Call of Cthulhu on the real Ghostbusters.
I don't want to seem like I'm beating a dead horse, but I feel like we found a spot of interest here with our Ghostbusters 2 scriptment, where we've got Act 1, we've got Act 2, where now one of the guys is possessed and they have to convince him out of the whole thing.
Well, Act 3 is Bill Murray coming out of retirement and doing
and
it. Although I feel like the because what he said about the him coming out and it's their child in danger and stuff like that drives it. I feel like we've actually also got a Ghostbusters 3 in the works a little bit here because that's a separate thing. One of them goes over to the dark side, basically.
Right.
I don't think necessarily we want to do that in 2, but maybe in 3 that's a place to go with it.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could write a pair of sequels with both in mind before we just fucking writing them?
No, of course. I mean, that's what you ought to do. You ought to sit down and be like I feel like if you feel like your story could have sequels, you should at least go, all right, what would these be?
And not have it be like a Pirates thing or I guess a prequels thing where, no, this whole thing is one big story. Just have it be so that the next story has all the little footnotes in the first movie so that when you go back to watch it, it seems cohesive.
Exactly. You have to at least have an idea of where you're going so you can be like, you know, because you're not going to know when you write the first one. You have to at least write down an outline of the third one and go like, oh, you know what would be really good if I could set this up in the first one and then put that
and
in.
This is
which obviously they couldn't do with Ghostbusters 1, but they could set up stuff for Ghostbusters 3 with number 2.
A lot of people will disagree and a lot of writers go, I like to just find where, but personally I believe I have come to believe in the study I've been doing of writing that but when you start, you have to know where your story starts and where it ends. And you have to know the ending when you begin, because it's a road, it's a journey that you're trying to take your audience on.
Are you distinguishing between story and movie?
How do you mean?
When your movie starts or when your whole saga starts and when it ends?
Well, that's the thing, is if you're making a movie and there's even this thought in your
idea. I like how
she's
trying so hard to like bang him.
She's a lot hotter in Ghostbusters 2 than she is in Ghostbusters 1.
I like the reversal of normally, you know, normally the guy is trying to seduce the girl.
You can cut away from Neo getting dumped into the goo into this.
This has got to be 3 degrees.
This is
gnarly.
3 degrees? What do you mean by 3 degrees?
The temperature. Like, it's freezing. Oh. They shot this in winter, and they're covered in fucking goo right now.
Yeah.
And from what I hear, they had to shoot this twice.
This is not a comfortable scene for these guys.
Yeah, they shot that. Yeah, this is method acting right here.
Let's go ahead. Let's get this.
How
Let's
did you prepare the role when you were covered with purple slime?
We hated the slime.
Purple slime.
Oh, man. I bet
I don't think they had any trouble playing irritable in this.
Yeah.
That was not a problem.
If there's an idea, if you're doing a movie,
that's
and you
why there's
think
not
there's
much
a
coverage
possibility,
in this scene.
Yeah, it's a wide and a close, and that's it.
And a couple of inserts. Yeah. If you think there's a possibility of sequels, and you think this thing might turn into a saga, yeah, I think it's your responsibility to decide
to just put some hooks
in there. What is the logical end of this ultimate saga? And granted, it's tough. Granted, it's tough because you have no idea what's going to be a hit.
Well,
and what isn't.
Is it fair to say that every sequel that has failed in one capacity or another has just been a failure of imagination or failure of requirement on the part of having a sequel in the first place? Does it seem like one of those
Sometimes, things where
it
hasn't extended
so.
The story? It's the kind
and
of thing,
any failed sequel is just didn't really have anything else to say. That
right?
Was it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like why did you do this if you didn't have anything
a sequel
to
that's
add?
Right? A sequel that's
just pitching in for no
purely
reason.
As a business thing as a studio like oh that made a lot of money. Let's make more of that people will go pay to watch. And that's because studio people, again, as Jerry Seinfeld so famously said, entertainment is not their field.
Marketing is their field.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the people who run studios nowadays, you know, generally, with some exceptions, but generally are business people. They went to business school, and they don't see there's any difference between marketing a new Ghostbusters movie with marketing a new car for this year or a new refrigerator. You know, the line is, you know, the problem with movies as art is that they have to be a business, and the problem with movies as a business is that they're an art. So, you know, a studio executive can have a very hard time not getting why Ghostbusters shouldn't have a sequel. They were like, but it was very popular. Yeah. Of course we should make a sequel.
It will make more money, therefore we should make it.
Well, yeah. Here's something that interests me is that...
But artistically, there probably isn't a story to tell, or you know, they didn't come up with one in this case.
If you gave me, and who knows, in a vacuum where Star Wars wasn't this huge thing in all of our lives, if you gave me the screenplay for A New Hope, or maybe not the screenplay, if you gave me A New Hope, if you gave me Star Wars and said, how do you write a sequel to this? Even I go, all right, well, I want to see this kid's kind of training as becoming more of what he wants to be. You know,
well, the logical conclusion
is... seem like all the obvious things to do, and yet Empire is this glorious sequel that's perhaps better than the original, and yet it's the obvious choices. Is that just because it was an open-ended story to begin with?
Not necessarily. I mean, if you look at just Star Wars and you look at the ending of Star Wars, you go, okay, well, logically there's more to this story because the logical conclusion of this story is...
to become a Jedi like his dad.
That, and they defeat the Empire, and they overthrow the Empire. And that doesn't happen at the end of Star Wars, so obviously there's more to that story. That's a very obvious example.
Darkman was in the bathroom, so I want to real quickly go back into that.
You're not supposed to fucking...
I'm sorry. I know that, but I want to get
that's
your insight.
Don't look behind
away.
The curtain.
This is radio, not TV.
I know that. I want to get your insight. And Darkman, I love your hat. I want to get this insight onto this thing where...
he is wearing a lovely hat.
God, it's amazing. It's
I'm not
really
wearing
tall.
A hat, you guys.
Oh, see, now there you're
just
doing
in case.
It.
All right, anyway.
You're supposed to just roll with me, man.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I denied. You're not supposed to deny anything.
I'm totally naked and I have a prehensile tail.
By the way, for those watching the movie, she's about to go talk to the baby. Anyway, go ahead.
We were talking about how it seems like if you gave me Star Wars and said, write a sequel for this, the logical sequel is Empire Strikes Back. What makes...
You'd be surprised.
What makes the logical sequel...
There's Splinter of the Mind's Eye as well, which was written before Empire. It was a book that was...
Is that an EU novel?
Yeah, essentially.
That's the very first one ever.
It was a book that was written, that was commissioned completely without Lucas's input.
Is it good?
A sequel to Star Wars.
I actually
haven't read it.
I liked it. It was because I was, you know, when that Star Wars movie came out, I was like, ooh, now there's a Star Wars book. I'll read that.
But it's totally
contrary. It can't even be retconned into submission. It has nothing to do with what is now the EU.
What we were saying is that it seems so obvious. It seems like...
I love this joke. This is a hilarious joke. Almost 50% of us voted for you in the last election. Do the math. That means one of them voted for the mayor.
Anyway. It seems like the obvious choice, and yet, for one reason or another, Empire is... Empire, and then Ghostbusters 2 is Ghostbusters 2. Like, is it just because Star Wars the movie was more open-ended than Ghostbusters was?
I would say, like, there are no...
Is it just that it was a universe film?
Yeah, I mean, you say Empire is the obvious choice, and maybe that's true, but I mean, there's...
Not all of it, but Luke becoming a Jedi
sure.
is at least
but
the one you go
I mean,
with.
There's a lot of obvious, what you could call obvious choices in Matrix or whatever, and like where do you go from there is the question, and you can look at it and say, well, obviously you need to do this, that,
you're
and
you're
other.
Looking at it with some benefit of bias.
Well,
yeah.
And Matrix didn't do it, but the problem, I think the challenge with Ghostbusters, okay, this may be twofold. Number one, there is no obvious choice
for Ghostbusters.
For Ghostbusters, because there's nothing next. It's like, okay, they're established, they're great.
Because there's no saga,
and
like
then
Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. Which you could potentially create, like you can introduce something to be paid off in 3, and then you've got yourself a saga, right?
Like with Pirates.
Yeah, or even Star Wars, practically. Although
yeah,
that
true.
Has the defeat of the Empire, like you said.
Real quick, but, the number two. Huh? Get to number two, because I want to go off of number one, but you said you have 2 points on this whole thing.
Point number two is that Dan Aykroyd is fucking insane. Like,
yeah.
The real thing is, like, and again, I read the Cinefex on this, and I actually got more insight into the story development process from there than almost anywhere else.
In Cinefex,
yeah, because they were talking about how it was so difficult to do this because the story kept changing and some like of the original concepts versus et cetera, et cetera. And, like, the original story, it was going to be, like, fucking Dana got caught in a fairy circle in fucking Ireland, and they had to take this underground tunnel that was 2,000 miles long, and it took them a week to get there and stuff like that. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell are you talking? Yeah. And Dan Aykroyd is crazy. Like, that's just all there is to it. And Harold Ramis is the one who comes in and fixes it, right? Yeah.
Bill Murray's brother.
Yep, right there.
Brando Murray.
Yeah. Now, may I point out that we're just retreading with some cosmetic, you know, coats of paint on top. We're retreading the first movie still. We have a meeting with the mayor, and they're trying to convince
the mayor. Blows us off.
Instead of putting him in jail, they're sending him to a mental institution. But it's...
Wait, how did they end up in jail in the first one? I can't believe I'm the one asking this, but I've had a lot of champagne. So,
Walter Peck puts him there.
Peck does it. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, it wasn't the mayor.
Do you feel like... Peck had to go to the mayor.
Peck convinces the mayor that now we have the new guy who's being the Peck.
Is there a chance they felt clever?
This is pretty, by the way.
Is there a chance they felt clever? Like, we're... Oh, it's a mirror of the first one. We're geniuses.
No.
I think at a certain point, like it was probably the kind of thing, and you almost see this with stuff like, I mean, people have accused Avatar of basically being the same movie as Dances with Wolves, right?
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing where it's the same,
as a lot of movies.
Right. Here's a story I want to tell. Where's it like it's almost cheating, but as long as the story is interesting. I love how he's playing with the and hurts himself. But yeah. It's almost cheating in the sense where you're like, all right, I have this interesting world, and I have a general idea of the story I want to tell. So you gank a structure that
right.
from somewhere else, and you just use that to kind of hang your elements on.
TVtropes.org.
Right, yeah, and that's how you do it. But there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think, as long as you're telling a new thing. Because it's like, you know, okay, so Avatar is Dances with Wolves. Well, Dances with Wolves took place in whatever, the Civil War, Avatar is... Dances with Wolves with fucking gunships and aliens.
Yeah.
I'll watch that movie.
You're damn right.
From a folklorist perspective, I mean, there's different, you know, dramatist perspective.
Right.
I mean, you know, the numbers vary, but, you know, dramatists and folklorists will say that there are only like 47 stories. That's
Campbell would say one.
Yeah. Well, no, there's more than there's more than the hero's journey. There are more stories.
It depends on who you ask, but there's like 3 or 6 or 12 or 42 or something.
I have one called the 36 dramatic situations.
Right.
And really, when you read, you know, when they're broken down to its barest points, you really go, yeah, that's pretty much all the stories there are. That's it. And the rest are just sort of, if you do something that doesn't at least follow one of those things, then what you've got is a collection of scenes, probably with stuff blowing up.
Yeah.
Now, here's, by the way, speaking of the sort of hodgepodge nature, I just want to point out that this scene always, of all the scenes that are just kind of like clammed together, this one is such a
left
field. Like, why is he in a flying baby carriage with his arms stretching out?
Yeah.
I mean, this was clearly like a Hail Mary idea of this has nothing to do with anything whatsoever.
Yeah, this is completely breaking its own rules, because it's like, wait. How does he have the power to do this? Like, how does he...
He just asked Viggo for the... Yeah, I want the woman, but, you know, he comes and he takes the baby by flying as a... He's dressed as a nanny, and what does that have to do with anything whatsoever?
You know what's hilarious to me? Again, reading it from the Cinefex. This portion came from Harold Ramis was writing a script, and the script involved this baby that became, like, super intelligent and started kind of walking and talking and stuff like that. And what struck me as so hilarious was he was basically pitching it as a horror movie. Like, that was the scariest idea he could come up with.
That is pretty scary.
He was just like, I just thought it was... And that's why he didn't make it. He's like, I thought it was just too terrifying.
That's why
it couldn't be done. I was like, wow.
That's why Baby Geniuses is so scary when you watch it.
Yeah.
Trey, if someone wanted to read more about the 36 basic stories, where would they find that?
I'm sure they thought this was funny, by the way.
I'm sure they thought it was funny, but they didn't give any thought to, like, what does this mean? And why is this happening? And
what are the rules here?
What does this have to do with anything? It's literally a little book I have from it's a book about drama, and it's called, I believe it's called The 36 Dramatic Situations, so feel free to look it up.
But you can go to the Word Player blog. I believe we mentioned it once or twice before on the podcast. But Terry Rossio and what's the other guy?
Ted Elliott.
Pirates of the Caribbean guys.
The Pirates of the Caribbean. Aladdin,
and a bunch of other shit. Sorry, guys.
Aladdin and a whole bunch of other things. But they have a blog, and it's one of the links on theirs.
Again, a callback. Like, this is... This is the essentially the same speech they give in the prison
yeah.
about the ancient that, Babylonian
your
god.
Girlfriend.
Is that there's the guy that's Bill Murray's brother?
That's yep. that's Brian Doyle Murray.
Brian Doyle Murray right there.
It's weird because he looks like Bill Murray, and B, I recognize him from other shit.
And C,
he's done lots of stuff.
C, yeah. he's actually younger than Bill Murray.
Is he really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
He's in
he balded faster.
Yeah.
He's in Groundhog Day. He's the mayor in Groundhog Day, or was some city official in Groundhog Day. He's in Caddyshack.
Don't look at me. I think these people are completely nuts.
He's been in a lot of Bill Murray's movies, but he's been in other movies as well.
Wow. Ooh, paper. It's like 20. It's like, that's the 25th sequel of American Beauty right there.
You want to know the most beautiful thing I've ever seen?
Serious this. Fucking
this
business.
70 billion papers.
Do you have any idea how complicated your circulatory system is?
It was like they were all dancing.
This is
with
a hard. Me. This is a hard shot. I mean, they've got all the wind machines in New York, and they're
steady
following her all the way
yeah.
up the
it's
staircase.
Like when you watch Aviator and Howard Hughes is like, I need 26 cameras. We need 26 fans.
Yeah. We need a jet engine.
We need to create a gigantic hurricane.
And the Metropolitan Museum of Art, or whatever this is.
So now I want to go back to what you were saying about the 36 dramatic situations really quick, because if you get even more fundamental than that, what you need for a story is a character who really wants something, whether it's tangible or a person or whatever. And
more or less, yeah.
Essentially, you need a character who really wants something, and then something to get in his or her way.
Yep. And then to overcome.
And then to overcome, and that's your story. And so there are only so many things in the human experience that a character will want desperately enough, and only so many ways you can justify those things. And then only so many kind of genres of obstacles
yeah,
you can
I mean,
put, there,
ultimately,
put in their way.
Ultimately,
this gets you back to the man against man against nature, man
exactly.
against self
right.
thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Ultimately, people will rail about originality and stuff like that. And to an extent, that's
nothing
true.
Nothing is original.
To an, extent, yeah. that's true. But to another extent, it's like if you made something truly original, like no one would like it because
you would,
it would be
yeah,
unrelatable.
Exactly. Right. It's like when someone first came up with the idea of doing something other than a drone chord for harmonics. It's like, that sounds... If you went back into the 1600s and played them Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, they'd be like, this sounds exactly like shit.
Right.
They'd be like, I don't have any frame of reference for how this is supposed to be. It just sounds terrible to me.
Right.
You can't introduce new stories to people because it would blow their minds. They would just not accept it at
and
all.
It's not that you can't do new art forms or that everything has to follow some rigid structure.
It's just slowly evolve.
Well, it's just that, or it's that, you know, you're not.
That's you don't relatable.
Have to, well, it doesn't have to be. You're not making like not all ideas are all things. Like here's my idea. You know what that is? That's a song. That's an idea. That's a song idea. Here's my idea. That's a play. Okay. This is my idea.
True.
That's a novel. Your idea is a novel. Yeah. You know, they have formats and there are structures.
I had those jammies. I had those Winnie the Pooh jammies.
Oh,
when
that's
I was
awesome.
Little, but
you know, so it's not
that you.
Not from this movie.
It's
I
Michael,
just
it's
happened
Michael.
To have the exact same jammies.
So it's
yes.
not that it's not
although
that,
mine were blue.
It's not that everything has to always have these you know follow these exactly rigid structures. There's plenty of room for maneuvering, and you know,
I like the song that's playing right now.
Eugene
by the
Levy
way,
and Andrea Martin, by the way, are both Second City
well,
alumni with Harold Ramis and
Cannibal Girls, which Moranis. Was on the marquee. There is Ivan Reitman's second movie.
There you go, and so with they were in it because it's
right.
a Second City movie. So
Trey, you were saying novels plays,
whatever. By the way, I'm just saying, and now here we're retreading the oh my god, the ghosts are overrunning New York City montage
right.
from the first movie.
As a matter of fact, this sequence was going to be in the first movie, and it was too expensive. This mink coat things in particular.
And wasn't the like the Titanic arriving, wasn't that originally going to be the
Hindenburg
in the first movie?
Yep. I don't know about the first movie, but it was originally going to be the Hindenburg.
Okay.
And then they made it the Titanic. And it's actually very detailed. Like
yeah,
there's seaweed
motion.
And dripping stuff. And
really?
This is Tippett, as a matter of fact.
That's right. It does look Tippett.
That does make sense because the Hindenburg actually landed and crashed at
New Jersey.
Lakehurst, New Jersey,
yeah.
Several hours away from New York. So.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't quite make sense.
And Titanic was trying to get to New York.
Yes,
so.
The Titanic would be more appropriate. So we were saying just that, you know, I don't think it has any negativity against Avatar whatsoever that it's like Dances with Wolves because it's like 500 other stories. It's,
right.
it's all in the telling. It's like, you know, it's all in the telling. It's all
it's
in
the
how
context
you,
of yeah. what you do.
It's
the details. It's the specifics. We talked before about
it's Cheech.
The specifics.
Cheech.
Yeah.
That goes back just then to our...
better late than never.
It's funny. Later in the history of Down in Front, you'll hear the Titanic commentary.
Or maybe
and we talk
before.
About,
we don't know.
We talk about how in 1985, they found out what the Titanic's damage actually was. This
is
89, and that doesn't represent the damage
they
knew about at all.
They've done the wrong damage. Yeah.
It was just
it's
giant
Ben
hole.
Stein. Hey, it's Ben Stein. Fuck you.
It was Ben Stein.
Fuck you, Ben Stein.
Yeah.
God, didn't that guy ever have... dark hair?
I knew you were evil when you wrote for Nixon.
Yeah.
Not only Ben Stein, we entered the scene. We had a guy who's been in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies. He was the lead of Hard Eight, and he's been
and this guy,
a bunch of others.
Was on Mad About You, right?
He was one of the main characters, I think, and also
yes,
Sin
Brian.
City.
Here's a cookie.
The toady.
Yeah, yeah, the toady that we've been, yeah. that we've seen.
Yeah, he's been, he's that kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's actually, well, he's not. No, he wasn't the buddy in Mad About You. He wasn't that guy. But he's in a movie that I love very much, Miracle Mile. He has a brief cameo in Miracle Mile, which is great. We haven't even touched on, and I'd like to, well, before we get into our big kick-ass slimy finale, we haven't even touched on Peter McNichol. My favorite Peter McNichol role.
Museum toady guy.
Yeah, museum toady guy. He's Vigo.
From the Upper West Side?
If you haven't checked out Dragon Slayer, and make sure that you don't get Dragon Heart by accident. I'm talking about Dragon Slayer. I'm talking about the movie that was made out of ILM not long after Star Wars.
Wasn't it nighttime and now it's covering up the sun?
It's,
anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, like they knew what they were doing with this movie. But Dragon Slayer is made by a lot of Star Wars folks, and Peter McNichol was the star. He is, in fact, the Dragon Slayer. A very, very, I think, fascinating. And it was the movie that in which they invented go motion, and the dragon is go motion for the most part.
It's go motion being stop motion where it jiggles to make motion blur?
Where it's computerized stop motion where you actually, in those days, you would move. You would pre-program the stop motion, and it would actually move while the camera was being exposed, so you had motion blur.
No.
So anyway, Dragon Slayer is, by all means, go check out Dragon Slayer, because it's a very it's great. The effects mostly still hold up. It's a very subversive movie, because it's all about religion and politics. It's got a whole bunch of religious and politics subplots going on in it, and it's got a kick-ass dragon, one of the best dragons ever done on film to this day. And Peter McNichol is the star.
Lightning.
And
he
has great lightning. It's a very dark, twisted kind of movie that I love very, very much.
I like that they're a
starring
slogan.
Peter McNichol.
Their slogan has been shortened from "We're ready to believe you" to
"We
up,
believe you."
We believe you. Yeah. Whatever you're going to say, we'll believe you.
Which
makes sense from the private sector perspective. They're like, you know, whatever you want to say, we got a $40 consultation. If you want to tell us how you were abducted by aliens.
Yeah,
we don't
sure,
care if it's true or not. We will come and visit you. Sure.
Happy to.
Now, earlier I thought it was interesting that the suits they were wearing were like a dark gray, which is different than the tan that they wore in the first one.
They've gone back and forth.
But now they've gone back. Okay, have they been going back through the entire movie?
Through the movie,
okay.
They've been going back and forth. It's a big thing because I've made Ghostbusters props for Halloween and such. and there is actually a thing where you There's the khaki ones, which are kind of classic ones, and you
right.
can go either way. And then there's the dark gray ones, which are just the Ghostbusters 2 ones.
Okay.
You'll notice in Serenity, Malcolm Reynolds is wearing darker clothing than he does ever in Firefly, Brian.
It's not unlike how there are actually different versions of Luke's lightsaber.
Right,
in the Star.
Right.
There's a difference between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. No one noticed that in the movies, but the fucking nerds,
they know the
difference between
I'm not going to lay down any judgments whatsoever.
No, I'm not either.
I
know the difference. I'm right. just saying.
Anyone that happened to be listening to this that was normal is now gone.
Yeah. Yeah. We also should point out that
look at that.
While we're talking about casting, our villain, such as he is, who really has, you know, so far the ultimate threat to the universe in this movie has done nothing but make a painting bulge.
Right.
By the way, we should point out how dangerous our bad guy is.
Yeah. 90 minutes in, almost, and
he's deformed a painting several times.
Yeah.
Our
this
bad
is
guy.
The second time we've seen the proton packs.
Yeah. But if you like your trivia, the villain, the actor playing the villain, was one of the terrorists in Die Hard, one of the more faceless terrorists in Die Hard. You see him, but you recognize him if you know to look for him. He's got a little ponytail.
That's interesting. He says save them because their proton packs aren't doing anything. And earlier they mentioned that the proton packs have a half-life of 5,000
years.
So we can go forever.
Trey, I feel like you got cut off earlier when you were talking about the zeitgeist and how, no, this idea should be a novel. This idea should be a song. This should be a play.
Yeah.
Do you recall where you were going with that, or is it too far gone?
That was the idea. That was the gist of it. Is, you know, the real problem with, you know, sequels of movies is sometimes the idea that the original movie had, that was it. That was the end of the idea. You know, it wasn't a saga. It wasn't a series of stories. It was a story. And when you told, as you were saying before, generally speaking, to be relatable. You know, you can make a movie about all kinds of things, but to be a relatable, basic story.
Lovely anamorphic flaring.
A story is about a person or people who want something. And the story is how they go about getting it, what gets in their way, and whether they get it or not. That's a story. And as soon as the story is over.
I just want to say, when I was really young, I was confused. I thought they were going to ram it with the Ecto-1A. But
I see what they're going for.
Yeah.
But, you know, your story is over when the characters get or don't get definitively what they were trying to get. You know, either they succeed or they fail.
So on those very simple terms, then a movie or a B movie becomes, do they get it? Do they not get it?
Right, and then
or
and
did they get it? Are they happy with what they got? And well, what are they,
and as soon and, as soon as they have either gotten it or absolutely not gotten it because they all died, if you're making a tragedy or whatever, your movie is over and you need to roll your credits immediately right. or as soon as you can because everything else is filler. Now, as to whether once you've told that story about the people who wanted the thing and whether or not they got it, is there more to the story or yeah. did you finish it? That's whether or not a sequel is actually valid.
I think your point is very good about definitively did not get what they wanted. Because right. if it's not definitive, if Vader just goes off into the ether and the Empire is
right,
still there,
right. it was
you got
open.
Yourself
because,
a sequel.
Right, because Rebel Alliance, what they want is the Empire to fall.
Yeah.
And they don't have that at the end of Star Wars, ergo, yeah.
they sequel. They have won a victory, so it's a satisfying enough part ending to that particular story.
Yeah, but there's right. more.
There is room for more.
Yeah.
But if the end of, you know, at the end of a movie where everybody dies... What's the sequel?
Yeah,
exactly?
I've heard people saying, for example, people are like, oh, they're going to make a sequel to The Departed. I'm like, no, they're not.
Yeah.
Please.
They might make another New York crime story, but, yeah. you know, they're not, it's not really a sequel.
That's not how big the windows are on
no,
the top of
they're
the,
much, much
the
smaller.
Statue of Liberty.
I actually remember... at some point, going
Wait,
to the Statue of Liberty,
smaller than
oh,
that?
Way smaller,
oh, much, much.
You
smaller.
Can maybe get your face into them.
So the Statue of Liberty is way smaller than I thought it was.
Yes,
it's not,
oh
it's
yeah,
not that big.
The Statue of Liberty is way smaller than you think it is. Absolutely,
I remember learning how big they actually were and being very disappointed because I had this image
right.
of that size in my head.
No, yeah. everyone does. I mean, they have yeah. the same thing in Cloverfield. Like they've got the scene where the Statue of Liberty
right.
goes rolling down the street.
Yeah.
They're like, it's about 20% bigger than the real thing because
yeah.
in people's heads, the Statue of Liberty is really,
really
big. And when we did it to actual scale, like from the blueprints
it
or whatever,
tiny.
It looks small.
Interesting.
Now the one thing...
Okay, this doesn't make any sense. Even accepting the magic of it, it's like, all right, I can accept that it can make the toaster bounce and stuff like that, but it's not going to create anatomy for her under the robe. Like, she should
points
be...
Points of articulation.
She should be bouncing up and down the street if we're going to
yeah.
do it that way. She cannot be walking and you see her knees under
yeah,
the toaster.
Well,
anyway.
which is what's funny, though, is I was just about to say, this is about the only part of this movie that I think was worth doing and is valid.
Uh-huh.
And at least captures the fun and the spirit of the first movie, you know, and,
yeah.
and you miss.
They've seen some shit tonight,
and you miss it partly because you're not getting the music, which is what are they doing? Your Love Has Lifted Me Higher. What song are they playing?
Yeah,
yes, higher, higher.
Did I miss something where she just blew Rick Moranis?
No, she just dressed him in the suit.
It's pretty clear that at some point she probably at least
she's blown him once or twice before, but this scene where you know they've sort of justified by you know the slime and the positive and the music, you know, it makes a toaster dance. It can, you know, if it can make a toaster dance, I buy the you know this is the piece of magic. It's one piece of magic to me. If it can make a toaster dance, it can make the Statue of Liberty walk around.
He's got
and
the earmuffs.
It's a good, satisfying, fun scene to have the Statue of Liberty. It's the one new interesting concept they've come up with in this whole movie is instead of a giant monster walking down the streets of New York, this time
it's
tame monster
okay.
under their control. It's the one good idea in this whole movie is that the... You know,
I'm
and,
with you, Trey.
And
I love this.
And it's
I
badass that the, you know, it's this part here with the music going and everything else and they're, you know, they've gotten, they're back on top again. You know, and it's the Statue of Liberty is going to come kick ass. I mean, that's a great idea. It's the one good idea in this whole movie is this sequence. And then they don't do anything with it. All she does is walk up to this thing and hit it with a torch. And then later you
and
see
falls
her
over.
You see her lying there dead. It's just totally misused. But for 2 minutes, the movie works great.
So unfortunately, the answer is I want a sequel. No.
Yeah.
Go make another movie with the same actors
sometimes,
and the same director and writer and have fun with it. Do something else. Guess what?
And then go,
sometimes,
is done.
Sometimes
and then go
the right
a
answer
film
is
by
no.
Ivan Reitman and you'll make the most
but,
of them
but,
the same
I
amount
mean,
of money.
Quite honestly, there is more you can do with the Ghostbusters. It's not a,
Does
it's
this
not,
bring us to Ghostbusters 3?
A universe movie, so to speak, but I think there is a universe.
There are more episodes.
There's more episodes, exactly.
Yeah.
There's more that you can do with these characters and in this world.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Well, it's worth saying that at this point, Ghostbusters 3 is still a figment of a I think they're doing it right now idea. But do you have faith in the idea that Ghostbusters 3 could work?
I think it can work. I've heard some things that a lot of people are like, oh, that's going to suck.
This,
but I'm
this
like,
I believe, remember being a particularly unimpressive bit of Slimer puppetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the bit that you can actually see them practicing.
Yeah.
Although it's more
clearly needed lots of practice.
Yeah,
I think there's a shot of him in the end credits where he's wiggling his eyebrows, going, "Look, I have cable operated eyebrows."
Yeah, but
anyway, go ahead. Oh, our villain might do something other than deform a painting.
Yeah,
any second now.
Ghostbusters 3 is currently the script is being written by a couple of writers from The Office.
Great lineup there.
You know, it involves a new team of Ghostbusters to replace the people who have gotten the originals who have gotten too old.
Yeah.
And there are rumors that the Judd Apatow gang is getting involved with that, and I'm
we'll
like,
see. We'll
all those things sound good. Like, it actually sounds good to take the script out of Aykroyd's hands, basically. Because it's like, because like Lucas with Star Wars, I think he's probably...
Too close?
He's too close. It's the kind of thing where he's like, he wants to make the movie he always meant to make, and not the movie, not the continuation of the movies he's made. You know,
that's an excellent distinction. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, Ghostbusters 3 would be like the weird kind of bizarre off the wall movie that it was, or that Ghostbusters originally was, as opposed to what it developed into ultimately. Whereas these other guys, the buzzing of flies to him,
he's Viggo. You're like the buzzing of flies.
And then the great payoff where he's not even there. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So they
apparently did that rappelling down from the
ceiling.
Yeah,
it was definitely them.
Way,
and you know, and again, it's a great idea that for 5 whole minutes now, this movie has worked. You know, it's like, geez, it only had 90 minutes of wrong choices to get us to this point.
I think the ending is good, but again, I mean, we talk about Viggo not doing much, but we don't see Gozer till the end of Ghostbusters either. You know, but we see elements of what.
We see the stuff leading up to Gozer.
But I think the problem is that, you know, the whole point is Gozer is the worst thing of all this building activity, and Viggo's been here the whole time.
And that's it.
It's a question of, like, well, what does Viggo do exactly? What is he threatened to do?
Right,
you know,
right.
As someone.
Well, you see, Trey, just before his head died.
Yeah.
Death is but a door, time is but a window, I'll be back.
As someone,
real scary.
As someone pointed out about it, is that the Fantastic Four sequel where they have a fight with.
You know what's funny? I didn't even read the subtitles earlier because we were talking over them. I literally remember that line off the top of my head. Anyway.
But they have a fight with Dr. Doom and they destroy the city and they kill him, even though in the story he hasn't done anything. I mean, it's another one of those cases. Yeah. It's like, what was the movie that we were watching ourselves here recently where it's like, oh, it's a Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
The bad guys are bad guys, but they don't do anything bad the whole movie. Not one single bad, evil thing justifies what happens.
Yeah,
to him.
I mean, Viggo hasn't done anything bad. He's just utilizing what's already there to come back, and the threat is he's going to do something bad, but really, like... What is that?
Well, of course, he did fire a rocket launcher at the LAPD on Nakatomi Plaza. So, you know, screw him. In fact, I guess he'd already done it by this point. He'd done it like a year earlier.
I mean, my friends from college, we quote a lot of movies. And I will say, for whatever reason, a lot of more Ghostbusters 2 quotes are in our rotation than Ghostbusters 1 quotes. So
I can't believe he can withstand the photon.
Like what? Like what? Yeah.
There's not a lot of quotes.
There's a lot. Buzzing of flies.
Okay. I will sometimes pop off with, everything you're doing is bad. I want you to know this. Because that's useful.
That is good, yeah.
The pizza line, Thai, Chicago, pizza.
But think about how many original Ghostbusters are not even references. They're just vernacular terms.
Yeah.
Cats and dogs.
Living together. Mass hysteria.
Yeah, it's got to be the whole thing. It's got to be the whole thing.
And then,
I've always loved how the baby's just like, all right.
It's true, sir.
That guy looks like Kurt Russell with rock star hair.
Yeah, he's got Farrah Fawcett's hair all of a sudden. When he lets it down, it's all pretty.
Yeah, and here we get to the point where they are going to defeat him with lullabies in a second or two. Or I think it's auld lang syne.
Kurt Russell and Jackal with a Y.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So here Bill Murray gets his whole long speech, and he's not even that funny.
Yeah,
sadly.
Unfortunately, he's not.
And it's just very awkward.
They sort of
way to do this,
and they sort of run out. Yeah, the poor Sigourney Weaver is standing there pretending to be tied up in a piece of hose, and everyone else has to sort of do this "I'm paralyzed" thing. You know, it really seems like something they just sort of came up with on the day. Okay, what if you're all just paralyzed and you can't move?
And the funny thing is, you look at this, like, again, from a story and just like character motivation perspective, what exactly is Venkman trying to accomplish here? Like, if the slime becomes
out
more
in Southern
powerful,
California's beautiful San Fernando Valley.
If the slime becomes more powerful with negative emotions, what exactly do you accomplish by pissing off Viggo?
What are you thinking?
Yeah.
And why is he, you know, he's one of those Carpathian.
That's a good little moment.
Yeah.
That was good to get with the baby, leaning back.
He's one of those Carpathian guys who shoots evil rays out of their mouth.
Yeah.
Which is apparently his secret superpower.
I don't mean to end up summarizing the movie.
The Who's in Whoville are singing.
Yeah.
I don't mean to summarize.
And there's the dead Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, it just fell over. I hope it didn't crush anybody.
Without summarizing the movie, summarize the
story. Yeah, there you go. There's the 2012 moment where.
Jesus Christ, guys.
Go.
Without summarizing the movie, summarize the story. What has happened to the Ghostbusters in this movie? They have stayed Ghostbusters?
They were broken up. They came back and became Ghostbusters again, and their business is going well.
That seems to be okay. That seems like an all right sort of summary.
Sort of, yeah.
I mean, I could see a movie wherein that's the story, yet it works.
Sure. That's what I was saying right at the beginning. I was like, there's a version of this that works where they went out of business at some point, but I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on what
the difference
is. Of course
they're going to try so hard to make this work.
To be like, I'm in this movie.
And I don't know. Everything just seems to take on a different additional layer of meaning after 9/11 with this whole, like, oh, New Yorkers are going to be nice to each other. Because I don't know if you guys remember, but after 9/11, everybody in New York was very nice to each other.
Yeah, there was
it was very much
inexplicably
like this,
kind for
perhaps us, I was a bad American for thinking of this at the time, but I thought of Ghostbusters 2.
I didn't think
you were a bad American in the early, you know.
I just sat there and I was like, yeah, those American flags, where were those before and where are they going to be a month from now?
Yeah, you know? Well, that's true. But this idea of like, we're not going to be asshole New Yorkers to each other anymore.
We're gonna be cool.
Nice.
So after all this rigmarole, if he's gonna possess a baby, he could possess Ray anytime he felt like.
Yeah.
It. You know. Again, it's sort of like
I do love this.
What's
bit.
What's the logic of this exactly?
This random, completely extraneous Z plot with fucking Rick Moranis, isn't even really satisfying. Like, there's no set. Like with Gozer, there was a satisfying "Don't cross the stream." Yeah, 20 minutes in, and now
because it was a character moment.
Yeah.
It was like we're going to sacrifice ourselves to save the universe.
Right.
That was what made that resonate.
And this moment is just like, we're going to shoot it.
We're
going to
shoot it. We're going to shoot it until it's dead.
Yeah.
And I think that was now that I'm looking at it, there's another missing ingredient where yes, I can see the value. It's not the worst thing in the world that the crowd, I guess because it's midnight, the crowd spontaneously began singing "Auld Lang Syne." Although why they're singing it around a giant, you know, slime covered museum?
Yeah, there's a fucking ball over there. Dick Clark's been doing this for
years. Yeah, the party's not in Times Square this year, clearly. But I think, like for example, it would have been good if Rick Moranis or someone who had understood the positive vibration angle and led the crowd. You know, give the character. You know, listen, everyone. It's midnight. And get everyone to sing. You know, and then that's helping.
Happy New Year's, everybody.
That would have at least helped. I agree. That would have been great.
It's not bad that they spontaneously came together. I see what they're trying to go for there, but I just think it would have been better to have one of these characters be the one to go, you know,
yeah,
we got to focus positive energy.
Yeah.
That's what we need
right,
to do.
Because it would have been one of the main characters doing something.
Yeah, as opposed to it just happening around them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
None of the characters are doing the actual doing of the movie.
Yeah.
It's just happening.
They're just waiting for an opening. They shoot their rays and it's over.
And by the way, yeah, exactly. And we haven't really addressed it, but he's basically Louis Tully in this movie. He was possessed and now he's not.
And now he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Trey, as the only member of Dunn and Friend who was an adult when this movie came out, what was the anticipation and then the revelation after this?
As I covered before, it's like we're all
stoked.
We're all very excited, God, yeah. and then we started hearing about it, and it started to sound a little dubious. And then we finally saw it. It was like, well, they all showed up and they all kind of did what they do, but it just, you know, as sequels go, it was not nearly as much fun as the first movie. It just felt like, wow, they just, you know, needed the money.
Yeah, there's really nothing happening. They just kind of show up on scene
and then,
on screen and do stuff.
And it's over.
And let's even end with, this is the same ending from the first movie where they walk down the stairs and the crowd is cheering.
Once again, I gotta feel like maybe they thought they were being clever.
Uh-huh.
It's got to be something where it's like, there are so many. If there is a parallel, you'd be like, oh, they didn't realize they rehashed the exact same plot point. But every single plot point's the same. I got to wonder if maybe they just thought they were being clever and trying to make a mirror story.
I don't know.
If
they did, this is a failed experiment. They didn't work.
Although I do notice they're using the same font. So go, guys.
Yeah.
Well played.
Well done.
I like the use of outtakes behind the credits here. I think this is the first time I saw this.
And as I recall, there is an end clip with the Slimer where he looks particularly poorly puppeteered.
Yeah, we're gonna see. No, he gets a credit at the end of this block.
So
he gets his own. I like that.
See, just turn.
That's very Buster Keaton.
Turn
right
Rick
there.
Moranis loose. He does his thing, and that's what you want.
He's not even funny. Look, he just gets the thing where he's putting on his elbow pads.
Yeah.
That even in the funny bits at the end, he doesn't get to be funny.
Okay.
So the implication is that he did not have one funny even outtake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, now for my part,
Kurt Fuller.
This is Teague. We're going back around the circle. Obviously, this is the worst way to watch a movie is for Down in Front.
Now, this obviously had to be, like, both of these sequences had to be shot for the credits because they're not from scenes.
They're from scenes. They obviously, you know, they obviously are just unused parts of the scenes that
Will Duschendorf, he's a cute one.
The Duschendorf's very nice. Yeah,
there he is.
How do you qualify that statement, Michael?
Yeah, look at that. Huh? Look at that terrible sourcey eyebrow movement.
I'm sorry, but there are ugly babies in the world.
Yeah,
there are, and there are cute ones. There is a gradient, and one of them, Will, is on the closer end of the cute gradient than Hank is. I'm sorry.
Okay, for my part, this is Teague. We're going around here. This movie is not one that I have a memory of, and probably at some point after this commentary, I'll watch it and get an opinion of it. But from what I had seen,
I feel almost exactly... This is not based on the conversations you've had, I promise. I feel like I've just watched Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I really, really do. And it's like, I see these words. Hey, Mirren, way to go.
Yeah, no, he came in and he changed a couple things, like the proton streams behave a little bit differently.
Ooh, look at that. That's awkward.
Yeah.
Ooh.
The proton streams behave more like lassos and stuff like that than they did in the first one. They've got more of a personality to them. Because that's why he signed on for it. He was like, I think we can do more with it, effects-wise.
I even see in the subtitles, as we've mentioned before, we watch this with subtitles just so we know where we are. I feel like I've seen subtitles that are funny jokes, and it's like, I feel like I just watched Ghostbusters in I don't know Ghostbusters form. So I look forward to seeing this without you know, this conversation, and just with the words, and thinking, my God, that was a funny little movie that was completely redundant.
Yeah, the best part is the little funny things they say. It's, you know, it's all one big vehicle for mostly Bill Murray, but also Peter McNichol.
Actually,
to
not
say,
very much Bill Murray. In
he has a few moments. I was like, my favorite joke that he does, and I didn't even see it pass by, but I remember it is his. It's kind of a stretch, but she goes, they're putting the baby to bed. She goes, will you help me put him down? He goes, sure, you're ugly and you're a drain on your poor mom.
And you're a terrible burden on your poor
terrible
mother.
Terrible burden on your poor mother. You know, he gets his good lines, you know. Hairless pets, weird. You know, he's just doing the Bill Murray thing. But you know, it's a shame they didn't have a movie to have him do it in.
Brian? Ghostbusters 2. Come on. Ghostbusters 2.
I'm of two minds. I mean, there's the six-year-old that's still very alive and well in me. It goes, Ghostbusters. I don't care. It's Ghostbusters. All right, boys, it's the Ghostbusters. And, you know, but then, I mean, especially now having watched it and talked about it and going, okay, this is what we could
what
do.
What went wrong.
This is what could have been done and would have been great. The UN and this and that and could have been a great story. And... Yeah, I mean, it's very, very disappointing.
I feel like you're having that Wild Wild West thing that I had.
I
never had a problem with this. It was just Ghostbusters 2, and now I'm like, I really see what this could have been.
It very much is exactly that. It's very much your Wild Wild West or Phantom Menace, where it's like, before, it didn't matter. It was just Ghostbusters. It was, it was just, you know, these moments. Maybe there's not a story, but there's some great, great moments in it. Maybe they're not great moments. But now I see that there's a story lacking, and there could have been a much better story with the same moments and even better moments.
Trey, anything to summarize?
By the time this movie came out, I was in the business. I was starting to work in the business. I was working in the effects business. Pardon me. So I was especially paying attention to the effects and kind of going, wow, they kind of ripped off some of our blob technology. And literally, the guy, Tim, I'm not going to name any names, but their names are passing right by on the screen right now. There were people who came to the blob set who, you know, literally like, we're playing with our blob tech stuff.
I love that there was one Tim on the screen when he said that. And he's like, I'm not naming names.
what Tim? What?
Yeah, go ahead.
Did I name someone named Tim?
Yeah.
The people came to from the thing came and messed with our stuff and you know all this is common knowledge. It's not like we're proprietary blob stuff.
It's not stealth technology.
Exactly. But I was kind of like, you know, I watched this and I was like, wow, it's like the blob. You know, they could have called me. It's all slimes and tentacles. But you know, these things don't work out sometimes. But the Mike Smithson, woo. I know, Mike. Howie Weed, these are all people that I was getting to know at the time. But this was a movie where Bathtub Trainer. Now, how's that for a title? Is that a great title? Bathtub Trainer and Bathtub Wrangler. You know, these are all – everyone works for everyone, so this knowledge kind of percolates. It's not like they ripped off our blob technology, but it
plus 200 other artists and technicians. That's an interesting credit. I'm sorry, Trey, to interrupt.
It's all right.
I've never seen that before.
But watching this movie just struck me like, you know, wow, this is great work. I mean, there's a lot of great effects work going on here, but this movie is just not good. And what I'm curious about is everybody involved in this movie has done before and since very, very good work. So my question would be, it's not that do we realize this movie is subpar. Did they know? Apparently Bill Murray did. While doing it, we're kind of making a turd here, but, you know, I always did want that second house in Big Bear.
Well, Murray said he was disappointed with the final product, so he may not have known at the time.
Because you never quite know when you're working on a movie if you know the vibe may be different than how it turns out.
It
may feel great and not turn out well.
Was flesh and blood in this?
No, but it's yes. In the scene where
we're talking about the Oingo Boingo song.
Ray is on the phone and he's got the like cap on his head and he's like communicating telepathically with the slime. You can kind of hear it in the background.
Yeah, okay. It's just a little throwaway. But the question I was, you know, curious about is, you know, as you were saying, are they doing this on purpose? Did they do this on purpose? Did they go, well, we'll just make this first movie again. We won't try really hard. We'll show up. We'll have some fun. Did they try to do something else and they kind of fell back on this? I mean, I'm curious, what was the behind the scenes? You know, how did these people feel about it when they made it? And did they realize that this was, you know, well, the check cleared. I guess it's okay.
I feel like we've done enough movies at this point where it has to be asked on Down in Front at some point, and why not now? What do you do in a situation where you're like, I love what we're doing, and yet I realize what we're doing will be a failure upon the measure of what we're doing? I feel like what we're doing right now will not measure up to the yardstick of what we've done before or something like that. Can you go to the writer, director, and just go, I am so very down for this. However, what you've done is not working.
It depends on the power in the relationship, certainly. If you're just, you know, if you're
Star
just
Wars a, comes to mind.
If you're just a, well, if you're just a comp artist, you're not going to go up to George Lucas and be like, sir, I'm not so sure about this. Do you remember we...
Because people tried. I mean, we all know people at ILM who were like, I'm working on the Star Wars prequels, and then they realized they were they were working on.
Right. The line from The Phantom Menace was, I feel like George is raping my girlfriend.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I'm helping him hold her down.
That was Ryan's line, right?
Yeah.
I was quoting someone from ILM who said, you know, this
well, Ghostbusters 2. You
know, I think Ryan said something similar.
There's this woman I love and I've worshipped all my life, and now I'm holding her down while George rapes her, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Well, remember on Geeksa, we interviewed Ron Thornton at one point, and I asked him essentially that question because he was a visual effects on Star Trek Voyager, and I essentially asked him that question. It was like, as a visual effects artist, how shitty some of those episodes were going to be? And, I mean, he had his answer, and if you want, you know.
Well, there's not much you can do about
it. Did he care? You know,
his answer was essentially like, yeah, I mean, you know to an extent, but there's nothing you can do.
Right. My job isn't, for certain people, it's like my job isn't to care about that. My job is they bring it to me, and I do what they want.
The best job I can.
I do the best version of the shitty thing they asked me for. Right. Yeah. So.
All right, let's get around the table here now.
All right. We already went around the table, except for me.
Yeah, we skipped over.
Oh, that's right. I was leading up.
Well,
I got me.
Because we knew that you, the resident Ghostbusters guy, would have the summation.
You got to give your long outro. I said, I don't remember this movie, and I look forward to seeing it without this, so I can be disappointed all of the new. And then Brian said the same thing. And Trey, you know.
It barely registered. It was just kind of like, wow, I hope it's the Michael Caine King quote once again. It's where we used it on the show recently with the Michael Caine. Talks about some bad movies he'd been in. He was in that whatever Jaws he was in.
The Revenge.
He was talking about. Did we use that in a quote? When did I use that quote?
I don't think so.
It's a Michael Caine quote. He said it recently in an interview. He said he was in Jaws 4.
Jaws the Revenge. Yeah, number 4.
Which, you know, one of the worst of the
The worst
bunch.
By far.
You know, and someone in an interview asked him about it. He brought it up, and you know, it's like what was that all about? And he says, well, you know, I have to admit, I've never seen Jaws 4, but I've seen the house it bought, and it is beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, that goes back to me just loving Michael Caine. He shows up in Muppet Christmas Carol, and it's completely there. Like, fuck yeah, Michael Caine is doing Muppet movies now.
Mm-hmm. I just hope that, you know, everyone's house that they got from Ghostbusters 2 is lovely.
Yeah. Although, like we said, you know, Bill Murray was not happy with just taking the paycheck and going. He was unhappy.
I don't think he gave it to charity.
Oh, no.
I don't think so either.
He took the check.
But he didn't take Ghostbusters 3 for the last 20 years.
As of the end of 2009, coming into 2010, there are only Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2, and here we are at the end of Ghostbusters 2. Dorkman, how do you feel?
All right. Here we go. Yeah, no.
There may
be
a Ghostbusters 3 that changes everything.
You know when you care about a person, when you care about a person, no matter who they
are. Quiet, everyone. I want to know where this is going.
Significant other or a family or just a really close friend. It's like, and you love that person, it's like they may do things that you don't agree with. You get in arguments. You may not even like that person, but you still love them, right? I don't really like Ghostbusters 2, but I love Ghostbusters 2 because it's Ghostbusters, you know? And that's just how it is. Like, this is Ghostbusters 2. I've got Ghostbusters and it's great, and then Ghostbusters 2 is an extension of the story that I accepted it before I knew to question it, so it's just there. It's Ghostbusters 2. If they do a Ghostbusters 3, that's the point at which they can fuck it up for me. But as far as it
now
goes,
you're a well versed film.
And
viewer.
now I know, but as far as it goes, like we've said before, Brian and I, you know, Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2.
They
exist in the same universe. Ghostbusters 1 is much better. It's preferable. It's the one I've watched far more often than Ghostbusters 2. But they're both Ghostbusters, and that's just the way it is.
As a Star Trek fan, I completely understand where you're coming from.
There you go, fair enough.
Has Down in Front and this episode of Ghostbusters 2 changed anything about how you see it?
No, because I already knew that before coming in. Like I said, this is not a good move. Compared to the first one, this is vastly inferior.
Although it's not a direct parallel with your actual life, Ghostbusters 2 is your bad high school relationship.
Yeah, basically.
It's like the first boyfriend-girlfriend position
that
I had.
But she taught me so much.
No, totally.
I learned so much from her.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly like that. It's like, well, that was That didn't go so well, but you know what?
That was not healthy.
That wasn't healthy, and ultimately...
My God, I learned so much.
But it's an experience I clearly needed to have.
I had to have it. I'm glad I went through it. I would not want to go through it again, and if he called me, I don't think I'd get back
together. Ghostbusters 2 is outside the prom in the parking lot waiting for the taxi.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Ouch.
Exactly. So I mean, that's just... That's how it is for me. Like, I don't... Ghostbusters 2 did not disappoint me. Even today, it's like, well, it's not that great, but it is what it is, and it's part of the story. So
I feel like giving you a slow clap out of compassion. Yeah. Just like, I feel so bad.
No, seriously, as a Star Trek fan, I completely feel you.
I am totally
on the same wavelength.
Yeah. How could you not?
All right, now this has been Down in Front. You can always find more episodes at downinfront.net. Go ahead and subscribe to our iTunes. Get a brand new episode every single week. Find our Twitter at twitter.com/downinfront. Go to the forum, register, and you know, discuss our various
shortcomings. Tell us why we're wrong. Tell us why this is the greatest movie ever
made. We're starting to realize the forum is literally just an output for those that think we're retarded.
No, but
that's good. That's what
it's
for.
And on the blog, I'm gonna dig up and link to those behind-the-scenes
shooting
videos.
The brand new stuff on Dorkman. Scott.wordpress.com.
I meant the Down in Front blog, actually.
Well, saying,
he's going to add value to our blog.
I'm trying to get everything that we've mentioned in the episode.
Sure, yes.
And as
or
as
just
always,
dorkmanscott.com, because if I change the site or whatever, you'll still be able to
just
find
Google
it.
Dorkman Scott. This guy's a publicity whore. Like
there's
Kevin
so many
Smith
of those on the internet.
There's 25,000 Dorkman Scotts, and only one of them is ours. My name is Mr. T. Christie, and I'm here with...
And the flowers are still standing.
Brian Finnifer.
That was number one.
Yes, so you're quoting the good one.
Dorkman Scott. Michael Dorkman Scott. And Trey Amazing Stokes.
Correct.
Thank you very much for listening to Down in Front. You can always find us. And until next time, thank you very much for listening. Good night. Good night. No witty phrase from the movie? Anyone? Really?
Nah, that's just all it is.
Winston.
It's like the buzzing of flies to me.
Michael.
Eh.